Blog Talk Radio.
Conservative conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find us on the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. And tonight we are talking about government's primary responsibilities and right-sizing local governments with Commissioner Chris Monzel, who we do have on the line. So without any further ado, I will open up this mic. Thank you very much, Mr. Monzel, for calling to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, Robert. Thank you very much for having me on tonight. I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate you coming on. And I know because of your schedule with campaigning and everything of that nature that your time is limited, so I'll get right to it. In my discussions with Mr. Ed Bell, it's been noted that the water and sewer rates are increasing in your county, and, of course, in many counties across the nation. What are you attributing to these increases?
Well, it's all part of the Environmental Protection Agency's kind of crackdown on sanitary sewer overflows and combined sewer overflows that are located throughout typically urban, older counties throughout the United States. And we in Hamilton County in Ohio have an old system that had a lot of these combined sewer overflows where both sanitary and stormwater sewers were combined together. And, you know, and then there was backups occurring whenever there's a major downpour of a storm coming through in people's basements and in backyards. And so we were sued by both the Ohio EPA as well as the federal EPA. And then because of that, we entered into a consent agreement to fix the system in order to eliminate those backups. And that is going to roughly cost us, per calculations, somewhere in the range of $3.2 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars. And that's back in 2006 dollars, which today is probably closer to $4 billion, is going to be the price tag that we're going to have to generate in order to do the fixes that the EPA has put on us for our sewer system.
And, excuse me. And do you believe that it's wrong that the EPA is mandating this, the improvements, or in the sewer system, or are they not outdated?
Well, you know, definitely, I think there's some aspects of the system that needs to be fixed. However, mm-hmm. to just kind of randomly, and you know, to me, I asked the question when I first came in, is, well, if I can fix those issues with the system, but I can do it for less than $1 billion. Mm-hmm. Will the EPA be okay with that? And the answer was, well, no, they expect you to spend that much money in order to fix the system. And to me, that's a case of affordability that I think sometimes mm-hmm. the bureaucrats in Washington or other state capitals just don't understand of what's happening with local people, local families and businesses. I mean, this amount of money is going to be crushing to our families and to our seniors on fixed income, to our local small businesses who will just move out of the county to one next door where they're paying very much lower sewer bills than they are in Hamilton County. And to me, it's something that I think a lot of times government bureaucrats just do not think about that affordability issue when they go out and make these, you know, decrees that says thou shalt fix this, but then they don't have to pay for it, right? They don't have to write the check. They don't have to go out there and figure out a way to do it. That is all placed on the burden of the local families and businesses within that jurisdiction, which is within Hamilton County, Ohio. And we have been trying our hardest to come up with ways to reduce that cost because, you know, our system is paid by the rates of the sewer bills of the individuals. It's not by an income tax. It's not by a sales tax. It's not by a property tax. It's done by the water usage of the individual family or business that is bearing the cost of these fixes to our sewer system. And thus, we have to raise rates in order to generate the income to do the fixes. So my thought process has always been just similar to a business. If you keep your costs low, you can keep your prices low. You can keep your rates low. And that's what we've been trying to do, is to come up with ideas and alternatives to what the EPA is mandating in order to keep our rates as low as possible on our residents in Hamilton County. And it's still been difficult. I mean, since I've been in there, each year we've had a percentage increase. They want a double digit, like 10, 12, 50% increases. We've been able to contain those to roughly 6 or 5% rate increases over the past couple of years. So it's a challenge, but I think it's vital in order for our local families and businesses to survive and be successful in Hamilton County, is to keep that rate increase as low as possible and the burden off them.
Well, it sounds like it doesn't matter whether there could be any cost-saving ways or doing it, whether that's, you know, depending on contractors or what have you, and saving money. They just say this is the dollar amount that you need to spend to get this fixed, and regardless of whether you can find ways to save money, it sounds like it's just a fixed dollar amount that they want you to spend. Does that sound
right?
Correct to you?
Right. In fact, there's one project that we have, which is a massive project. When the EPA first came in, they wanted us to build a tunnel. And this was going to be a massive tunnel that was going to collect, you know, over a billion gallons of stormwater. And it was roughly going to cost us over $550 million just to build this tunnel to collect this stormwater. And so we've come up with alternatives to do that. In our current project, the alternatives are actually still what we're going to build is more than what we really need for the situation of the amount of water that we need to collect. It's actually about 40% more than needed. And so we go back to the EPA saying, hey, can we, you know, reduce our cost by not building it that big, because we only need 60% of it. We don't need that extra 40 because there's not that much water there to collect. And they basically said, no, go, you need to build it. You need to build, even though, you know, they wanted us to build this massive tunnel to begin with, but this alternative we come up with is less amount of money, but still it's more than we need. And they're saying, you got to go forward. You got to build it, even though it's, you know, 40% more than what you actually need. So it's a classic case of overbuilding. In fact, when brought up about this, they said, well, this happens to cities all over the country all the time. You know, they overbuild and it costs more, but that just happens. And that's just the way it is. We just want the numbers to look good. And to me, that's unfortunately being borne by the ratepayers of Hamilton County. And at times, I think there's that disconnect between the folks at the EPA who don't have to pay the bills, who don't have to, you know, pick up the tab on these projects. Say, yeah, go ahead and build this extra large project because, well, it looks good. Well, in reality, we really don't need it that big, and we could save a lot of money for our ratepayers at Hamilton County by right-sizing it to make sense for the amount of stormwater that we're collecting. So it's a battle. It's a battle that, you know, we keep fighting here in Hamilton County, and I'm sure other counties like us across America are battling that same way against the EPA in regards to, you know, the issues of sewer systems.
You know, one of our panelists, Cindy Todd, she's in Florida, and I'll bring her on in a little bit, and I believe she has some stories she can tell about some of the things she's been dealing with down there. It does sound like that they're more of a one-size-fits-all, and, of course, you know, kind of top-down, where the federal government, and maybe also state government, you know, kind of going over the sovereignty of the local governments. But there's also a new tax to be voted on that I believe some have dubbed called the icon tax. Now, if you could tell us what specifically the tax is for, and do you support the tax? And now this is going to be a tax voted on by the
yes.
by the voters. And
yep.
so do you support the tax, or why or why not?
So just some background real quick. We
mm-hmm.
have a former railroad station in Hamilton County in the city of Cincinnati called Union Terminal. It's similar to other Union stations and railroad terminals that are across America in old towns. You got Union Station in Indianapolis. You got one in Washington, D.C. Similar type thing, a very grand, and actually this one is, a very built in the 1930s, impressive structure. It's, I believe, the second largest half dome in the world. So it's a beautiful building. But it stopped being utilized as a railroad station in the early 70s by the railroad companies. It still does have some passenger rail that passed through there, actually. But it kind of sat dormant for a while, and there was a group of local community leaders who decided to take that building and turn it into a museum center. Put a natural history museum in there, put a Cincinnati Historical Museum there, put a children's museum in there. And so that's actually been very successful. They've garnered about 1.2 million visitors a year on average. The county has been supportive of that museum center since it was started back in the 1980s. In fact, we've had several property tax levies. The voters voted to fund the Cincinnati Museum Center at Union Terminal to operate. We've probably generated over $70 million already in property taxes that have contributed to the moving of the museums into the building and to the operating of them for over the last 20 years. And so we came to a point where the current property tax levy was expiring this year. And we asked a group of citizens who volunteered to review our property tax levies to take a look at it and say, you know, we just kind of keep putting a Band-Aid on this building. It's got issues. It's old. It's starting to fall apart structurally. Has some major issues with it. Are we just throwing good money after bad? What do we need to do? So they came back and addressed a few things. One, they agreed we shouldn't just keep doing this operating levy on property taxes. We need to remove that. But at the same time, they felt that there had to be a vote by the community to say, do you want to save this building? Do you really want to keep this Union Terminal for generations to come, or do we want to move the museum center someplace else? And so within that kind of discussion, a group of community leaders came forward with a plan to renovate and restore Union Terminal. But at the same time, they added in another structure within our community called Music Hall, which is where
mm-hmm.
the opera and the symphony and the ballet do their performances. And they kind of threw language around it, and they called it the Icons. Music Hall and Union Terminal would be saving the icons of our community. And that's how they got the term icon tax. Well, for myself and my one of my fellow commissioners, the three of us, you know, we felt that, you know, Music Hall should not have been involved in this situation and in this decision. This was all about Union Terminal. That's where the county has been involved with. So we had to make a decision to put on the ballot whether or not we wanted to do a 14-year sales tax, a quarter-cent sales tax, to renovate both, restore Union Terminal and renovate Music Hall, or do nothing, or do something in between. And so it kind of came down to a decision back in early August where two of my fellow commissioner, Greg Hartman, and myself decided to just focus on Union Terminal to put a limited five-year sales tax, quarter-cent sales tax, on the ballot that would sunset in 5 years, that would generate the funds necessary to just restore Union Terminal. And that will go before the voters in November. I supported that. Going on there. We've had a relationship with Union Terminals for the last 20 years, and we wanted to give citizens an opportunity to vote whether to restore it or not. Music Hall, on the other end, was a bridge too far. We did not have any history with that building. It's actually owned by the city of Cincinnati, And, you know, we felt that it was not structurally impaired. It was not falling down like the Union Terminal building was, and that there was potentially other methods of funding that restoration, actually renovation of that facility known as Music Hall, that could be done without having to go to the taxpayers of Hamilton County for a sales tax. So that was kind of the decision that we made back in August. We'll see how that turns out in November. I think, you know, voters feel this is an asset to the community that they want to keep. They would vote for it, but if not, then they'll vote no. And we'll see how the votes turn out this November 4th. But to me, I think we made the right decision. We really cut, you know, the situation have going from a 14-year sales tax down to a 5-year, and tremendous amount of interest as well as fees of taxpayer money was reduced hundreds of millions of dollars by going to a shortened term that was more focused on one building instead of two. And we'll see how it turns out this November 4th. But I think we've already on our sales tax in Hamilton County, we can only do 1%. Already half of that is going to pay off two sports stadiums that we have for the Cincinnati Reds and Cincinnati Bengals. And to take another quarter of it, 3/4 of it, to apply it to two more buildings for 14 years. Just to me, was not the right thing to do. So limiting it just to 5 years and fixing an issue that actually reduces property taxes for the property owners of Hamilton County, because the operating levy expires, and then actually fixing the building and kind of restoring it was I thought the best option to move forward to give to the voters of Hamilton County to have a say this upcoming November.
I know a lot of folks are still upset about the stadium tax, especially with the Bengals stadium. Hopefully they earn it this year.
it would be nice. They're off to a good start. So we shall
see. Yes, they are. Looking forward for some more. But I actually, I know you're local. I pay more attention to Elder High School and what they're doing than the Bengals. But I digress. but back on point is, I know for the Music Hall, a suggestion, that I favor is actually, you pay tickets in order to, be able to use the facility or, go there. Perhaps, put the onus on the folks who actually use Music Hall and, just then pay higher ticket prices in order to pay for those sorts of things. And maybe to affect with the Union Terminal as well. But also we're talking about tonight, the responsibilities of the primary responsibility of government and right-sizing local governments. And so what has Hamilton County done in right-sizing county government, and what were your contributions, and how will you carry this over after this next election?
Well, it's county government in the state of Ohio is an arm of the state government, so which is located in Columbus, Ohio. County government is an executive branch. Our legislative branch is actually the state legislature, the state house, the state senate. They're the ones that pass laws that impact county commissioners and other county elected officers in how we do our job, so to speak. And basically, because of the issues in the economy over the last 8 years, roughly, 7 to 8 years, we have been impacted dramatically here in Hamilton County. But honestly, I think there was a lot of very important decisions that were made by previous commissioners as well as myself since I've been on there for the past 4 years of those seven, of spending what we have. We can't go out and borrow money or print money like Washington, D.C. We got to live within our means, and we can only spend what we bring in. And so there was some very hard decisions that have been made about cuts to the budget. We have right-sized county government to be 1,700 employees less. We've closed the jail. We've really have looked at those basic services within county government that are mandated by state law and, really got down to what we have to do and provide those services the best we can with the limited funds that we have. And it was very difficult. a lot of tough decisions. But I think we made those decisions instead of kicking the can down the road like a lot of other governments seem to do, from Washington down to local city governments. But I think it's positioned Hamilton County in a very good spot of being in that right size area. We've reduced our general fund operating budget well over $70 million, cut it in the last 6-7 years. We were close to $280 million for our operating fund within the county, general fund. And now that's been reduced to roughly just a little over $200 million. And we'll do it again this year. We'll probably stay flat to roughly be in that low 200, maybe $204 million for an operating budget. And it's just a lot of hard work. It's working with our other elected officials in the county who we set the budgets for their departments, such as the coroner or the sheriff and the prosecuting attorney, the county engineer. So, and it's hard because, you know, they're elected as well, and they want to go out and do their job. But with limited funds, we have to work with them in order to establish a budget that makes sense and that's within their means. They can't just go out there and think we have a blank check, because we don't. Again, we just can spend what we can bring in. The economy seems to be turning a little bit better over the past couple years, but we're not taking it for granted. We budget conservatively. And we try to get to a carryover balance of 15%. Currently, we're in that 12% range, which, you know, during these tough times is pretty good. And we're going to continue to build that reserve back up so that we're protected for another downturn, which could happen any time with this economy. You just never know.
And lastly, before I bring Cindy, because she may have some brief comments or questions regarding the first question we had tonight is, so how's your campaign going? I know we've, you know, it's going to be coming up, and the election is going to be coming up in, gosh, just a few months already. So, and then how can anyone, you know, of our local listeners here on the show perhaps help you out?
Well, we have 55 days until election, so it's going to go quick, but we're working hard. We're getting our yard signs out. We're going to community events, going door to door, working like any campaign I've been in. We don't take it for granted. We do a lot of grassroots effort to get the vote out. We have our absentee voters starting in a few weeks. So that begins. It's really not election day anymore. It's election month with the amount of absentee voters that take place. So we're going to be working to get a mailer out to them, as well as start doing radio and TV advertisement and digital advertisements as well over the next few weeks. I think we're running a good and very strong campaign, and we're going to be very competitive. If anyone wants to get involved, we have a website, just monzel.com, monzel.com. You can click on the volunteer on that, or look, you know, ask for a yard sign. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter as well. So you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. So again, it gives opportunities of walking in parades or going door to door or getting a yard sign. So, but it's, you know, campaigns are exciting times, a lot of hard work. I'm very blessed to have a great campaign staff helping me out, and the great staff at my county office who just go above and beyond the call of duty, and I just can't say enough for how lucky I am to have so many great people involved with the campaign and leading us to victory in November. So it's quite exciting, but like I said, we got 55 days, and we're going to use every one of them to the maximum.
Okay, great. And then real quick, because I know we're winding down on the time that you'll be able to spend with us, I want to bring our panelist Cindy in from Florida. Cindy, thank you very much for coming to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great, Robert. How are you guys doing tonight?
Oh, doing great. Welcome, Mr. Monzel, onto the show, Cindy.
Hi. Glad to have you on, Mr. Monzel.
Well, thank you very much, Cindy. Very nice to talk to you.
Well, sounds like you're having some typical problems. I was listening earlier with your explanation about what's going on with your sewer system. I got a question for you. What size city do you live in? What's the population of your city?
Well, actually, we're in a county, but the city of Cincinnati is roughly just a little under 300,000 people. The size of the county is pretty much in the 800,000 range.
Where
for
was
population.
What town was it that the water situation was? That Cincinnati that has to fix their water?
Well, it's the whole county. So we're very unique here. I think we're one of the unique setups throughout the country, actually, where it's a county sewer system. So Hamilton County is the one responsible for the financial management of the sewer system and setting the rates. But the actual sewer system is operated by the city of Cincinnati. So it's their employees that actually run the system, but the county is one that actually is the overall manager and financial responsible party for the sewer system. So it's a little strange setup. And the sewer system goes across many different cities within our county. So, but the city of Cincinnati is the one who actually is the operator of it.
Let me ask you this. Are there any people living out in the country who are still on wells? I mean, are there a lot of people still on wells?
Yeah, we do have quite a bit of septic systems that are still in use throughout some of our rural parts of Hamilton County. So they are not affected by this unless per state law, as I mentioned earlier, state law kind of directs the county on how to operate. If a sewer system is going in within an area, and per state law, if you're within 150 feet of the sewer system, you must tap into that, even if you have a fully functional septic system that is in compliance. Per state law, you have to tap into that sewer system, which I know there's been a lot of folks who are upset about that, which I agree with, because it's not fair. We've tried to provide – I'm sorry, go ahead, Cindy.
That's exactly what I expected you to
– Yeah, so we at the county have been trying to provide some type of recompense for those property owners who have a viable working septic system, that they can get some credit for that so that it's not just a total loss. So similar to, you know, when you trade a car in, you get some valuation for that. We try to prorate that septic system and take it off the bill of the sewer being put in. But until state law is changed, you know, I'm pretty much at that will of what the state legislature has imposed upon our citizens.
Right, and this is a classic Agenda 21 strategy, push people onto government services so that we cannot be independent. They want to be able to control us in every single area, and so they will be closing down more and more wells. They will be forcing people on city water and then charging them out of the nose for that water and for sewage and everything else. Water should be free. You know, if you can dig it out of your ground, it should be free. But the money that they're collecting from us is being used to redistribute wealth. Basically, that's what Agenda 21 is about. And your state, my state, and every state that I can think of has been affected by the Agenda 21 strategy. Our county and city property taxes are supposed to be paying for our infrastructure and public services. But instead, we have a separate charge for garbage, separate charge for sewer, water, electric, phone, school. Everything has, it's all parceled out. And we're wondering, just where is all the money going,
I like to call it's government by a la carte, right?
Yeah.
So we're paying a la carte for all the different services. Instead of getting your meal that you paid for, you have to pay for your salad and your soup and your sandwich and your dessert all separately, and it's just it's really causing an amount of burden on families and businesses, you know, not only in my county but across all of America, that is just overwhelming at times and just crushing those folks. So, yeah, I totally agree with you.
Cindy, I want to be able to, since we do have limited time here with our guest, is I see that Kelly Mordecai, he's a panelist from California. He'd like to chime in. Go ahead, Kelly.
Well, hey, yeah, it's nice to hear. Kenny, you're city council, right? Or are you county supervisor?
I'm a county commissioner. It's similar to, supervisor.
In California, we call them supervisors. I just want to throw out a couple suggestions, and maybe you guys have already thought of this. But I'm also a civil engineer, and it's quite common that these older systems have water and sewer to the lines connected together, which creates an undue burden, especially as development grows and grows. So it's common these pipes are together. There's technologies now where you can take a camera down these pipes and find out where these connections are between sewer and stormwater. And so if you find a way, that doesn't help. So what? Where does the stormwater go after you block it from the sewer line? You've also got leaky pipes that are old, and there's now technologies that'll seal the inside. You're finding out where groundwater is coming through. So there's ways to really reduce the amount of flow to your wastewater system. And if you do, well, of course you will, when you run into cross-connection pipes, there's another technology. They've actually done several of these. You can take the stormwater and put them into these chambers underground, and then the ground will absorb the water. It depends upon the type of soil. If you got sand, it'll soak it up like a sponge. If you have clay, it'll only hold it there temporarily. But, I've done several systems like that, not for cities, but for private clients with their stormwater. Instead of putting in a pond, we've got the stormwater system into the parking lot. So that's just a couple technologies. Your local engineers should probably know about those. If they don't, give me a call, but it's worked pretty well. And the other thing is, as far as funding, I like your phrase, thou shalt fix, says the EPA.
Yeah.
You might want to look in the, if you've heard of CAFR, Comprehensive Annual Financial Report.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
I've heard of it, yes. I haven't gone into it myself, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, there's some places online you can research. Keith Broders, he's a gentleman I can connect you with. But he has found quite a number of cities all over the country have, they refer to it in the CAFR that there's an enormous amount of excess of money, funds you may not have known about. And in these, some municipalities will invest in the stock market or bonds elsewhere or things like that, or they have large holdings in real estate or both. And it's surprising, like for L.A., for example, somebody did an analysis. The people there wouldn't have to pay taxes for like 5 or 10 years. There was so much extra money. And it's kind of a, even government officials don't quite know about it, but there have been holdings for quite some time and they've grown. So that might be a big to get you out of the hole there financially with the thou shalt fix people.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, and I understand your job in some degrees. I know four of my county supervisors. I know I think two of the city council member here. I just talked to one today. Sometimes you guys get into a very difficult position. Where you've got these laws to comply with, either state or feds, and then you get the public screaming, well, I don't like the city. Well, we have to do this. It's there's times where it's political, and there's sometimes you just have to. I admire you for not passing the buck to the next commissioner board. I think that's a lot of integrity there, that, hey, we got to deal with this problem now or it's going to get worse. You weren't looking out for your political gain per se, but for the gain of the county from what you're telling me. And I think that's very admirable. I wish a lot of jurisdictions, you know, cities and counties, et cetera, that they would really deal up front with the problem. In the city I'm in, they have not been charging enough development fees, and so the city stagnates in growth. There's not much for jobs. Whereas down near Sacramento, Roseville and West Sacramento, they started increasing the fees on development. And what that did was allowed for infrastructure to come in simultaneously as the city grew. And so the cities were growing very well and very healthily. It came out to be about, I know some of you guys are going to say, oh my gosh, this is bad. One subdivision that in Roseville was $30,000 a parcel. But that includes your stormwater, your streets, and your maintenance. It includes your sewer upgrades because the wastewater treatment plant has to be upgraded. You got your water treatment. All these municipal functions do take a dollar sign. And the cities that have seemed to implement higher fees, and all the other guest panelists are shocked at me saying this, but you know, because this is contrary to how I think federally. But with the cities, as they have successfully increased the fees to meet the needs, you know, school fees, that's another one, fire department, police, yada, yada, all these infrastructural needs and police force, law enforcement, et cetera, these cities have been able to grow and thrive, and the standard of living is pretty high. In the small towns where people complain way too much, I mean, I told one city planner, you got to put a zero behind some of these fees or this city won't grow. And so we're here with about a no-growth scenario. You know, it's like a snail's pace. There's a lot of drugs and alcohol. Crime's starting to increase. We got a lot of homeless. We've just got a lot of problems, and it takes courage, if you will, in the locale. It takes courage to increase the fees as necessary and somehow get the public on board so they can understand how cities can grow in a healthy manner.
Well, we're trying to do it with, you know, a common sense approach. You know, we definitely have to fix things, but we don't want to be, you know, such a burden on families and businesses that they will move away. But at the same time, you know, we're kind of in the consent decree with the EPA, so we're for federal consent decree, we're constricted on what we can and can't do in regards to our sewer systems. But you know, we are going to fix them. We're going to do it though in a way that I think is thinking outside the box sometimes and coming up with alternatives that you spoke at the beginning of using alternative means of compliance that it might be cheaper, less costly, and that keeps, you know, our rates lower, though they will increase. I mean, just by the nature of the amount of work that we have to do to fix the system. But if we can keep it at a minimum that doesn't crush our families and our businesses, I think we can keep Hamilton County thriving into the future.
Well, no, I'll tell you a story about stormwater, or I'd like to anyway. In Redding, California, which is about an hour south of Mount Shasta, the northern part. Anyway, in Redding, the city was expanding just fine, except they didn't put the right stormwater treatment systems, you know, ponds and what have you. Anyway, Cal EPA hit them with a $500,000 fine.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the power under the thou shalt fix clause, thou shalt not fix, thou shalt be fined. You know, so it is a really tight scenario that you're in. And I just like, I don't think I would want your job.
Yeah, well, some days I'm you know, between a rock and a hard place. But I think, you know, I'm trying to bring a common sense approach to it to figure out these problems. I'm an engineer as well, still am. That's my other job I do. But aerospace engineer. So I like to solve problems, like to try to fix things. You know, at times government operates a little bit different than the private sector, and we try to bring some of those ideas into it, and sometimes we're successful to have an outside approach that, you know, is more like running a business than instead this typical government, thou shalt fix this stuff. So that's,
yeah.
You know, that's the type of stuff we're trying to do. But I do apologize. I'm going to have to get going here.
We appreciate you staying as long as you have. And folks, just to let you know that Chris definitely stayed much longer than what we were, you know, first slotted. We only slotted about 20 minutes. He stayed double that. So we really appreciate you spending all the time with us tonight, Chris. And good luck on your campaign.
Well, my pleasure for having me on tonight, Robert. I really appreciate it. Thank you to your two panelists. Appreciate the input and you know, the ideas. You know, we appreciate you know, that generation of thought out there that is different than just the typical government way to do things. So, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you all tonight, and wish you all the best. Take care.
All right, you too. Take care, and we'll be keep an eye on his campaign. I think he's got a very good chance of winning it in November, and we're looking forward to it, and great if we can have Mr. Monzel back on the show. And so, sorry, Cindy, I didn't mean to cut you off. I knew he had limited time, as I said. I pointed out he did stay longer for us than was slotted for, so we really appreciate that. But I wanted to be able to get Kelly's comments in as well. And I think Dan tried to get a hold of me earlier. Just unfortunately, my concern is if I try to answer, then it could cut off the line. Of course, we're not in the extended period, so that's something that could be fixed. So I will bring it back to you, Cindy. But first, before I bring in two things, before I bring it back in, Senator Quick, I want to say welcome to the listeners from the CPR Network. So it's glad to hear that you're listening to the show, and we'll be speaking soon. So it's great to have you guys listening. And then also, second, last week, as you know, we did have a shortened version of the show because I had a procedure that I had last Thursday. And so I wanted to just thank everyone for their thoughts and prayers out to me. And they were keenly felt, so I really appreciate it. And everything turned out pretty good. I still got a few more things I've got to do with them, but you know, as Dan pointed out, the danger part of what I had to get done, I think is pretty much done. So thanks again, everyone, for your thoughts and prayers. So, Cindy, we'll bring it back to you, and then perhaps I'll try to be try to get a hold of Dan and see what's going on with him. Go ahead, Cindy. Kelly, do you hear Cindy? I don't hear.
I'm not here. See, Cindy left. Cindy, that guy.
I still
like
see
you
on the line.
Okay. Well, yeah, that guy. Sorry, what was his name? I kind of missed the first part.
Chris. Chris Monzel.
Chris. Yeah. Monzel. Yeah. He.
Commissioner Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Monzel.
Yeah, he's the kind of supervisor I'd like to see, commissioner. Sorry. You know, because they have to make tough choices. And my contractor friend, he's on the city council, and he's like, yeah, sometimes we're just in a rock and hard place, and we got to make these hard choices, and we got to, you know, keep the public's interest in mind. And he actually, I wrote a piece about Brian in the local paper. I wrote, Brian Foster, resign. And it came from a comment he said, which was, look, government should get out of the way and just let the private sector do its job. He said that on a city council meeting. The reason why I was asking him to resign was, well, in the end I said, well, he has resigned his desire for government to grow and grow. So he has resigned. You know, it was a real good positive thing. He liked it. I called him up before I put it in the paper. But he's one. We got two in our city council that doesn't want government to grow endlessly. So there are, you know, find a lot of good people in local government, and it's just a completely different mindset, and they're a lot more approachable. You know, they come out of the community, they're aware of the community's needs, they just use a lot of common sense. And I'm seeing that in this commissioner, and so it's, you know, it's kind of neat. It's not that hard to just go to a city council meeting or a county supervisor meeting, just kind of sit in and listen. And of course, it's all formal stuff, except for that one time when the mayor here wore a Mickey Mouse sweatshirt. But they're just people; they're locals. It's just kind of, and it's not that hard to get some things done. In some ways, we went before them. I'm just blabbing until Cindy comes on, or if you want to bring Dan on. But yeah, I'm a member of the homeless committee here, and we're trying to. We found some land the city owns, and so we approached them on Thursday. Me and they kind of like, well, why don't you do it? Okay, so we were just trying to get a feel, if you will, during the public comment period, where they might sell us the land, and we read their positive feedback, and we might have 3 out of 5. So I, you know, at the local level, what am I saying? At the local level, they're not so far out of reach.
Right. You know, it's important. I know, you know, this is a national show, but I do think it's important to have local politicians on, you know, people working locally, because that's really where it starts, especially, you know, a lot of grassroots. You know, it's from local politics, too. And that's where, you know, I think the lower you get down the chain, so to speak, I think, you know, the more genuine folks you can find, and they do have more of an attachment with the grassroots. Now, that, of course, isn't true in all cases, you know, with different politicians, but I would say, you know, in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah. Well, another thing, too, is that's kind of how you go up the chain of command to your state house. And maybe a congressman. You know, Brian's the kind of guy I'd love if he ran for county supervisor and then ran for the state assembly. I mean, you can see these guys, you get to know them over the years, and you know, you could find out if they're a person you'd wholeheartedly support. Like in my case, with Brian, yeah, Brian Foster, local city councilman. Because that's really, I mean, again, it's just the chain of command. And
local politics, we need to all be sharing our successes and our mistakes. You know, we need to be able to network together on a national basis. Okay, what's working in Cincinnati, Ohio? What's working in Volusia County, Florida? What's working in Sacramento, California? Not that anything would be, but, you know, what if there was something working well there? You got to share it. Are you guys there?
Yeah, we're here.
I wonder what Dan Gray is up to, because I'm about to violate the eighth deadly sin here. So.
Oh no! Go ahead. Actually, as I said, I was getting ready to say, I believe he called. Tried to call me while I was interviewing our guest, so I couldn't, you know, kind of click over, and you know, so I'm trying to find the number. I believe it's a new number for him. So go ahead and violate it for a while, or I could see what's up with Dan.
well, I was gonna
violate away, Kelly.
I was gonna let Dan violate the eighth. He's a little better than that at me, but I hope he's listening. I'm done teasing him here, but. You know, at the beginning, you were wondering, Robert, what is the role of government? Well, really, a couple key phrases, and that's about it. One key phrase is to protect people from people. You know, i.e., civil order. You know, obviously, if we don't have a navy, the Chinese would just come and love to get our resources. There's, you know, starving people over there, but you know. So we've got a Navy that protects us from people. Times, government has to provide for the people where individually they can't provide for themselves. For example, you know, roads, water, sewer systems, of course, that's where law enforcement comes in too. There is a definite need for government, if you will. And even the people at city council here, they've got a tough job. It takes kind of a strong person to be a good leader in those positions. You're balancing this and that. It's just the leadership that keeps a city from going undermanaged or overspending. And in a sense, there are leaders, and they do deserve on a local level quite a bit of respect. Protect people from people and provide for individuals can't provide for themselves, you know. At times a private sector will do that. For example, if you've been on the East Coast.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system, 5702255550.
Oh, we almost got his number. Whoa, good catch there, Robert. So if you've ever been on the East Coast, I said we almost caught
Dan.
I said we almost caught Dan's full cell phone number there.
No, anyway. I didn't. Yeah, that was kind of odd. I'm not used to that. Go ahead.
Well, anyway, if you've been on the East Coast, they have toll roads. They got quite a bit of them. And in the winter, that's actually a preferable place to travel if you're on the East Coast, because they have a really good system of maintaining the roads in snowstorms. My car died once, and the guy gave me a ride. And then I called the tow truck, and then, so this is in Pennsylvania, where Dan is. That's taken a long time, and the toll road system, and you got to pay, you got to stop every now and then and pay some dollars and this and that. But, that's where a big company or whoever did the toll roads, and some are state-run toll roads, but whatever. That's kind of a rarity, if you will, where, people individually can't provide for themselves. I mean, I'm kind of going back to where government boils down to, protect people from people, but do we have to pass endless laws? That's where environmentalism is kind of an awkward bird, because, there's sewage in somebody's yard, but how about endangered species? How does that protect people from people? It doesn't. It limits our access to resources, and my county here, we have some of the greatest resources in the country, and we can't get to them. And the public here is quite depressed. I don't know where that ever came in, but it's a frustrating thing. Oh, and by the way, the Endangered Species Act, this is kind of a news update. The Endangered Species Act is getting reevaluated by Congress and the House of Representatives. Of course, Harry Reid will sit on the bills. There's over 300 bills they're sitting on. Harry Reid is by himself to not get in the Senate. But the Republicans and others are starting to look at the ESA in such a way that they're going to take the abuse out of it. Now, they have, I think it's called the Equality and Justice Act, whereas some environmentalist wants to sue somebody or some government over not, that there's an endangered species, whatever, what have you, and all the games that the environmentalists will play. But at present, they get awarded their attorney's fees. Win or lose, they get awarded for the equality and justice. I mean, I'm not understanding how a bird that may or may not be endangered there's going to be funding for that bird, and there's been lies, like the spotted owl was a big hoax. But the Congress is going to revisit some of these laws so the enviros don't have a blank check. Recently somebody mentioned to me that if you take the enviros and put them back where they are now to 1920, in the 30s and the 40s, and all the permits you'd have to get to build a war defense, the Department of Defense, or actually it's called the Department of War in World War II, if you threw the environmentalists back, we would never have been able to crank out the industry to beat the Nazis. And the way he said it was simply this: if you threw the environmentalists back into the 20s, we would all be speaking German right now, produce fast enough to win World War II. I just thought that was quite a stunning thought.
Well, you know, you were mentioning something about roads a little while ago. In Florida, we have a system called SunPass system. So any toll road in Florida that you have to go through, just about, unless it was...
Having trouble hearing you, Cindy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hang on a minute. Maybe I can...
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Well, I'm on... I've broke another phone, so I'm on my grandson's phone, and it's not the best phone in the world, but what I was saying was we have a SunPass system here in Florida where pretty much any toll road you go on in Florida, you can just ride right through the toll station, the toll booth. They have lanes that are fast where you can just go straight through. And, like, your transponder that sits on your dash of your car, you know, sends back a signal that you just went through, and so you get charged on your transponder, and you get a monthly bill or whatever. Usually you put some money on there. You put some money on there, and then it comes off the bill as you go through the tolls. So we don't have to stop and start and stop and start. So that's one good thing about our toll system. But I still have a big problem with toll roads because that's what our taxes are supposed to be going for, okay? We shouldn't have to be paying a toll and paying our tax. I'm so tired. Like I mentioned to the guy earlier, I keep forgetting his name. What was his name?
Chris Monzel.
Monzel. Mr. Monzel, you know, I was telling him that, you know, all of these services that we're supposed to be getting with our taxes, we're not getting them. We're having to spend separate money for everything. I got to run down the street and pay a toll. I got to pay a sewage bill. I got to pay a water bill.
How much is your gas in Florida?
Today, $3.39, but I stopped at a kind of expensive store because I was in need.
Wow, $3.39 is better than what we've got up here in Ohio.
Well, there's a reason why I asked that, Cindy, because here in California, we're seeing $4.
Mm-hmm.
And a big chunk of that goes to the roads. So some people will complain, but yet it's a pretty decent system, particularly the trucks, because your 18-wheel semis, they tear up a road like, you know, 10, 20, even 50 times as much as a regular car, and they only get like 6 or 8 miles per gallon. So the taxes they're paying to maintain the road is a pretty decent system. We do have in Benicia and the Golden Gate, there's, I think it's $5 across the Golden Gate. I can't remember, but that...
Wow. It was free last time I went across it.
Well, yeah, I won't ask how long ago that was. But basically, I like that system with those two bridges because I'm up here in Siskiyou County. Those bridges are, 6 hours away? I'm not going to use that bridge. Now, the people going in and out of San Francisco.
No, it needs to be a city taxes issue, but the money that we pay in our city taxes, our county taxes, and our state taxes and our federal taxes, all of those tax dollars that we're spending are supposed to be going for our infrastructure. Instead, what we're paying for is the redistribution of wealth, basically, and for the lining of the pockets of every politician, practically, that's in office. And for the paycheck and the pension for every city and county worker, especially those in the SEIU, we're paying for that instead of paying for our services. That's what just really irks me.
I can see waste, other frustrations. What did Chris say? He reduced the county budget by, was it 7 or 70 million?
I don't remember. I missed the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first 5 minutes I didn't hear.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a huge chunk of change, though. And I, you know, they laid off some people and did some other things. It's like, wow, you know.
It's possible. It's possible everywhere.
Well, yeah, if they're able to save that much money, then what in the heck was going on years before?
I can tell you now that I've spent about two or three years, you know, finding out about our county and how it's run, I can see very clearly how if I was on the county council, I could do that kind of cutting. I could cut 10% easy out of our budget, easy.
Well, there's another thing, you know, I keep talking about the grand jury. California, we have a very unique system. If they pay the grand jury a lot more, I would bet you they'll have a huge return on investment because they'll find some kind of county waste that would easily pay for, you know, right now the civil grand jury makes like 50 cents or a dollar an hour for their service, which is below minimum wage, obviously, no benefits. But if the county were to, you know, triple minimum wage and then even get two grand juries, that'd be 23 people, or 19, and then 19 more, they could really start looking at the financials of the county, and even though it might cost $500,000 a year for all these people, I'll bet they would easily find budget cuts or potentially, you know, sad to say, spending fraud or mismanagement. Whitman, when she was running for governor of California, you know, she was the founder of eBay. She estimated that the state's waste in spending fraud was $8 to $10 billion. That is being
wasn't it funny how California citizens just didn't even care about that and they just decided not to vote for her?
Well, she was trying to get a statewide grand jury, and she also wanted to implement computer systems that would better track the accounting. You know, and she, I don't know if the Republicans
didn't
like her very well, but, yeah, well,
and
of course they like Jerry Brown, so, you know, they like Governor Brown, so, you know, we're still fighting.
I don't know why. He costs them a lot of money, so I don't understand that. But.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if you're the big money people and you know, you have your hands in Brown's pocket and he's got his and yours, you're all patting each other on the back, then I guess you can go with Jerry Brown. And then, all the people that are on welfare, they don't want a person like Meg Whitman in there. She's going to hold them accountable for welfare and find out all that fraud and all that.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Had she been elected, there would be people in jail by now, both on the government and private sector side.
They couldn't have that.
We couldn't have that now, could we? But Jerry Brown suffered from the environmentalists. He was trying to get they're trying to get some high-speed rail from Sacramento to L.A. And the environmentalists were butting heads with him pretty bad. And you know, he's a Democrat. And all of a sudden, he sees the frustrations environmentalists are doing when you want to do something. Like, yeah, hello. And I call this a funny story, or at least in my profession. I had this client in the Bay Area, and he had burned already $60,000. He was trying to do a parcel split, and some Bay Area acquaintance said, "Well, send me your deed." I looked at his deed, and come to find out, his parcels were already split by legal description, long time ago. But the assessor's parcel numbers, instead of getting three for three parcels, you just can say, "Hey, assessor, I just want one bill." So you get one assessor's parcel number, and I see this every now and then. People don't think that they think they only have one parcel because they have one assessor's parcel number. No, they combine the tax bill. Instead of three for three parcels, it's one. And, you know, they're glad to do it. It's convenient for everybody. So this guy had burned $60,000 trying to prove well and septic and this and that. And I look at it, dude, you've already got legal parcels. What? Yeah, go point this out to the
health department's planning department. A week or two goes by, and he says, I'm mailing them, and they don't believe me. Well, this isn't an engineering question. This is a or land consulting question. This is a legal question. You need an attorney. So he got an attorney. The funny part's coming up here. He got an attorney that showed them, look, legal description, parcel 1, parcel 2, parcel 3, it was convenience that you have one assessor's parcel number. Now, would you leave the guy alone? He's got three legal parcels. And let's go back to the assessor and have three separate. And the county said no. Here's the funny part. The client was a Democrat. He was the chair of the Marin County Democratic Party. In other words, big government, fat government, more government. He had reaped the whirlwind personally.
What is the word that I'm looking for?
Karma goes around, comes around.
Yeah, one of those.
There is a God.
Yes. Wow. That's awesome.
I just left it at that. I wish I could have rubbed it in his face, but professionally you can't do that. But I got on the phone, I was just so laughing, at the end conclusion of it, and never heard from him again. But it's just like, oh my gosh.
that's rich. That is rich. I like hearing stuff like that. They get their comeuppance every now and then.
Oh yeah, and of course a guy like him thought he might be special. And the government will do a special thing for him because he was the head honcho in the Democratic Party there. Nope, sorry.
Well, that Rosa Corey, the lady that started Democrats Against Agenda21.com, she was on this show.
Which I have to mention, I was had her on the show. Go ahead, Sunday.
She was a Democrat. And she got fed up with what she saw was happening in the real estate world, and that's why she got involved and started investigating things. So, there are some Democrats that they do have some sort of, idealism, and when they see that their idealism has been trounced upon by, party government, They do wake up. Some of them do wake up. We've got a couple here in this county that have woken up, and you see them every now and then. But Democrats are holdouts. They follow the 11th commandment even more closely than Reagan did. They will not.
What's the 11th commandment?
To say do no harm against your own party. Don't say no evil against your own party.
Oh, okay.
They will not, Democrats will not go after one another. They can be involved in the worst kind of corruption, and nobody holds them accountable in their own party.
Wow. Well, that's like what I mentioned before, which I want to assemble some attorneys to come to the show. The Fifth Amendment actually protects somebody, government corruption. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless under presentment or indictment by a grand jury. So the Fifth Amendment protects you. Well, if you have a Justice Department that won't sign the indictment, Rule 7 of Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure in Cox versus U.S., or so they claim, their buddies, if Eric Holder isn't going to prosecute a Democrat, they are so protected it's ridiculous. And that's why Ted Kennedy got away with murder.
Yep.
They can keep doing this. And the hypocrisy is just disgusting.
Here's another little piece of news. Here's another little piece of news. I don't know if you heard this. I think it was True the Vote that released this information just recently. That the Democrats have requested over 700,000 absentee ballots. Now, I think they were saying that's here in Florida. just for here in Florida. I cannot swear to that. It may be a nationwide figure, but I think that it was a Florida figure. If it is, that's an astronomical figure. And you have to wonder who is requesting the ballots. What are these addresses? Are they foreclosed homes? Are they dead people? Are they people who have moved out of the state or out of the county or wherever they're supposed to be voting at? Are they students that are voting in two different places, voting at home and then voting in the town that their school is in? There's a lot of ways for voter fraud, and that's one of the reasons that we have Eric Holder and President Obama in office right now, is because we have a lot of voter fraud going on, and until we address that and get rid of that, we may be sunk. There may not be any digging ourselves out of this hole.
Yeah,
that's one of the things our friend Jim
Conner
Jr. talks about, Kelly.
Oh, yeah, voter fraud, electronic election fraud. There's so many
mm-hmm.
categories. You know, there's, I can't remember the name of the firm that we put out their Deadwood list every year, but they're a political information company that has a ton of voter registrations and everything. I don't know how they do it, but their Deadwood report was, you know, like couple million were duplicately registered. There was like 3 million dead people, all sorts of things like that. In one county, in I think it was Massachusetts, one out of every voters was a deceased person. And what that means
wow.
is that if I was running for a county supervisor in Massachusetts in that county, I would have to spend out of 7 days campaigning, I'd have to spend 1 day in the cemetery to get elected.
That's a good one. That's a good one, Kelly.
Kelly, you always have such a good way of looking at things.
Yeah. Yeah, interjecting the humor here on Bard's Logic.
Well, you know, I've been talking to Robert about doing a show that features people who have lived in a communist nation or who have spent some time in a communist nation. And trying to get the word out to people, because that if these welfare recipients, food stamp recipients, child care recipients, and all the different recipients out there, people that make, you know, $25,000 or less, I guess, is the threshold. I'm not sure exactly, but whatever their low-income people, they think that by staying low income and not pursuing a job, a dead-end job, you know, something that, you know, would be just manual labor, they're too good for manual labor, so they're not going to pursue a job like that, that they could actually bring home the money to take care of their family instead of stealing it from people who do work. If they saw the results of full-on socialism and communism in different countries, if they saw the change that happens when communism takes over a nation, they may think twice about supporting Obama and helping him to get elected. And I'm not just Obama, but, you know, all the Democrats who are thinking like him, you know. I think they'd think twice about it, because the moment communists get a stronghold and there ain't no changing back, all that money disappears, because basically they empty out the middle class coffers and the upper middle class coffers, and even some of the rich that won't get on board with them. They empty out their coffers and then there's nothing left. And so the poor people just get poorer, and the middle class disappears, and they become absorbed into the poor people also. And I think that what they need to know is, as soon as the socialists gain hold in this country, the food stamps are going to stop, and the welfare is going to stop. and from then on, you will work for the government if you want to eat. And you will do whatever menial labor, manual labor, hard labor, you will do whatever they tell you to do. That's what happens in a communist nation. They don't take a crane or a backhoe or something like that to unload a coal train. They put about 30 little Soviet guys or 30 little Chinese guys up on top of that coal train with shovels, and they shovel it off by hand. That's the kind of thing that your technological stuff just goes backwards, and now everybody works with their hands for the government. That's what you see in communist nations. And then, you know, there's the secretiveness and the neighbors telling on each other, and it's a horrible, horrible atmosphere, and people lose their souls. I noticed the first thing I got to China, I noticed how empty their faces were. They had very few expressions on their faces. You didn't see a group of people walking together, having fun, talking, laughing and giggling. You saw individuals walking along, doing their duty, headed to where they were supposed to go for whatever the work their government wanted them to do. And that was that. And their heads were a lot of times they're just down, looking at, straight ahead at where they're walking. Just you look in their eyes and there's nothing. Nothing. And that's what our poor people can look forward to in the future.
Yeah. You know, Cindy, I think I told you that socialism really does work in reality, in practicalness. I told you this, haven't I?
Okay, you're going to have to tell me again.
All right, well, Lenin and Stalin decided to kill 20 million people. After that, there was plenty of food, housing, and clothing to go around. See, it works. Mao, he did the same thing. Estimates are up to 80 million. After you kill them, you know, tens of millions, there's plenty of food, housing, and clothing to go around. So, you know, it works.
Well, again, that's part of Agenda 21 also. We have to reduce the population of the Earth by 40 to 80%, depending on who you talk to.
Yeah, it's a strange, there's other factors at work, too, that, you know, I don't know if I want to go into it here, but, you know, there's a fundamental flaw of communism, is that, oh, you work for the best interests of your neighbors. Okay. Everybody knows practically human nature well enough. Well, my neighbor is not working for my best interest through the state. So why should I work for his best interest? Because he's not doing it, and those people over there aren't doing it. For the benefit of the state. Really? Well, it's a benefit for everybody. Yeah, no, sorry. Our country has prospered because with the Constitution and the way things developed from 1600s, 1700s, and then they really big in the early 1800s, is that you got to buy some land and keep the fruits of your labor. Not like the British feudal system, if you will, where you worked on the baron's land, you owned, what, 30, 40, 100,000 acres, and excess land, or I'm sorry, excess proceeds, the baron got to keep. You know, that whole system drove, plus religious liberties, brought us over here, and you got to keep what you worked hard on. And then you look at intellectual property. Now, why is it that America is so prosperous? Well, it's greed. Okay, it's protected greed. I'll name it in the worst case scenario. Patent. Okay, in the Constitution, you have the right to your patent for 20 years, exclusive right. What does that do? It motivates somebody with, you know, mile-high dreams, and they've created some technology that even though he could be phenomenally selfish about it and he could make a bazillion amount of dollars, the community as a whole is benefited from this technology. And so our technology has grown and grown and grown, And the idea to keep what you work for has made America great. Now, the Soviets, or the former Soviets, the Russians, they're in a hurting position because the SALT Treaty ended in, I think it was 2009. They didn't have the money to sustain some of this old equipment. So they, of course, wanted to come to the table. And we're like, no, thank you. We are, because of our mentality, keeping what you work for, we had the prosperity to maintain, you know, our missile silos and our submarines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, if you're looking at it from the perspective of national defense, our prosperity has been key to our national defense through the system of our Constitution, et cetera. The Russians under communism, their economy is hurting so bad that their national defense is hurting. And so there's certain reasons why they would want the Ukraine for the natural gas and oil reserves, because they've got to help feed a starving nation. So, and the Chinese are in a difficult position too, because under communism, people lose their motivation to work. Technology, it's pretty easy for them. They just go into the United States Patent Office through the Internet, and they do reverse engineering. I mean, they do. Yeah. And then I filed a few patents. And then that, you know, somebody who's been successful at patents, he gave me some advice. He says, look, you know, file your patent, but just get it out of the market as quick as you can and get a strong reputation, because even in America, they'll try to steal it. And then the Chinese, they'll figure it out. They'll reverse engineer it. They'll build it. And then they'll ship it over here and sell it for a third of the price. And we don't have a patent trade agreement to enforce patent violations with China. Now, with Europe and Canada and other nations, we have that, except you got to pay $200,000 to $300,000 to get that international patent for those countries that will honor it. But still, there's still countries, you know, I would dread some stuff go to Africa, particularly, you know, gold mining equipment I filed a patent on, because to be like, yeah, we'll just build it and sell it all over here. Who cares? But China is at least keeping up with technology, because they can just go online to the U.S. Patent Office and they can make money that way. It's really, you know, it's not that people are thieves, per se, with patents and new technology. It's just that they're lazy. You know, oh, here's four pages of goodness. Yeah, let's make it. Let's sell it.
It's Edward Snowden over there in Moscow that they might start doing the same thing.
What's that?
Reverse.
Missed that.
You know, stealing patents and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just all Snowden and others have to do in Russia is, assuming there's not a patent infringement agreement with Russia, yeah, all they have to do is just reverse engineer. You just look at the U.S. Patent Office. Now, why is that available online? Because if somebody else has already done it, you do the patent search, and you find out, oh, well, this is kind of similar, but mine is unique, and it actually works compared to this guy who was just tinkering in his garage. But you have to do a patent research on your own. And then, if there's an infringement, you have to police your own patent, which is really another frustrating something. But, but yeah, it's just in a sense, they have to have that. U.S. Patent Office has to have that kind of a system. But you would think that our government would be smart enough to require Americans to register. So that, you know, you can register with an account. Who are you? Only when you register and you prove that you are actually an American can you have access to this database. But, you know, hey, let's just give our technology away, you know. Let's just, there's some common sense things here. It's like, really? Politicians, why don't you protect the thing that has helped make America so great? Oh, and by the way, this is a historical tidbit. Thomas Jefferson came up with the idea of interchangeable parts. All right? mm-hmm. interchangeable parts. But, you know, I think, well, that's kind of a duh. You know, a tire goes from one car to another, if it's the right side, whatever. You know, you can same model car, all sorts of parts are the same. You just from one to the interchangeable part. I don't have to say anymore. When you walked into the patent office, they laughed him out. But, and they wouldn't give him a patent. But it is, that as far as our history and our prosperity, that was absolutely revolutionary that caused a massive growth in prosperity and exports. I mean, who'd have thunk? I was reading in the American Rifleman several years ago mm-hmm. about the guns of the Revolutionary War that the colonialists had. And I got done reading this and was like, oh, my, all of them were custom-made, every one of them. And you don't know if you had a good blacksmith or not, but a lot of times they wouldn't shoot. They would, you know, you pull the flintlock, it wouldn't shoot. All sorts of problems. Mm-hmm. I'm like, how in the world did we win this war with such crappy guns, you know, compared to modern standards, but they still did. But that was back in the day if everything was made custom. So there's reasons why we have had so much prosperity when we look into mm-hmm. this. And then there's reasons why we're going down the toilet fast with environmentalists and other things. You know, endless regulations and more regulations and welfare.
You got to remember, Kelly, what Obama said, that there's nothing special.
You didn't build that yourself.
What?
You didn't build that yourself.
Right. Well, there's nothing exceptional or you know, outstanding about the United States. You know, we're just another nation out there. Just, you know, we're not anything great. And so he has to perpetuate that philosophy by keeping us from being great. I mean, you have to take the greatness away from America if you want to keep saying it's not that great. You know, if you want to keep saying we're not exceptional, then you have to make us not exceptional. And I think that's what they're up to. They're trying to make us unexceptional. Just melt us into the big world pot. And,
well, if you think about the, you know, I mentioned that you keep what you make and you keep what you grow, et cetera, you know, you're growing tomatoes, watermelons, whatever, your cattle, you get to keep that. Well, in the history of mankind, because of a king, you would have all sorts of greedy kings that would want a lot of your excess proceeds. You'd have barons, you'd have feudal system. You'd have people basically that they were just barely surviving, you know, growing their food, tending their flocks, whatever. They were barely surviving. They didn't have time to develop technologies, except maybe some people that somehow got wealthy. And look at how America. Yeah. The what?
They want us to come back to that, where they have all the money, we work for them, and we're too destitute and struggling too hard to survive to try to get ourselves anywhere or to try to fight against what they've done to us. I mean, look how many hundreds of years we were in feudalism and nobody could do anything about it. We were powerless. I think it's a miracle from God that we had the revolution years and the Renaissance and all of that. I think it's a miracle from God.
Well, yeah, the American Great Britain were a big part of the Industrial Revolution, if you will. And, you know, from there, the gospel went all over the country, all over the world from these two countries. It was just quite stunning. And the simple premise of you keep what you work for, and then you have, you know, colleges and universities, and there is, one in 1,000 people has a college degree, or something like 1 in 10,000 has a master's degree or something like that. In America, we are just cranking out brainiacs left and right, you know, making the world a better place by our technology, say, for example, the computer. So many things have because we've had now really generations of
the idea of going to college, being doctor, lawyer, engineer, whatever. But it is, it has been a synergistic, positive experience that has made this country just so phenomenal, except all the leeches that we're getting on our backs from regulations and overtax, and somebody feels, you know, I feel sorry for person A. So person C, you're going to give your money to person A. What? Yeah. And I feel better in giving money. That's why liberalism and socialism is, feels so good, because I can take from person B, C, and D and give to person A. Here you go, person A. I feel better as a politician because I helped you. It's kind of sick. But, you know, I go back to the codependency issues versus what Benjamin Franklin coined the first coin, which is the Fujia, which on the back it said, mind your business. You know, it's just fascinating.
By other people's money, isn't it? Wonderful. It's a wonderful thing for other people.
It feels so good.
And speaking of not spending other people's money, but something that's good, is we've got Dan on the line. So let me go ahead and get Dan in. Thank you very much, Dan, for coming to the show. How are you?
You're late.
I'm sorry, everybody.
Busy.
I was.
He'll let us know what he was up to. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, first, I was going to say that was an interesting segue because I have no money and. I hope I make people feel good or bad, as the case may be. I was at an event with Charles Strange, our guest from the other week, and a whole bunch of patriots, southeastern Pennsylvania. And it ran late, and I got stuck, and I just it's my fault. I should have dragged myself away while all the interesting stuff was going on. But I'm here, and I didn't hit a deer on the way home, which is good.
That's good.
So, I have been listening to just the last part where Kelly was talking about prosperity, and I can't argue, obviously, with any of his points on what causes prosperity, which I'll boil it down and just say, how about liberty? But I will say this. It's not just about being those so-called progressives. They have sold this not as it'll make me feel good to take somebody else's money to do it. They'll say it because we have to. See, they'll take our argument of moral imperative to say it's the right thing to do to give. I tell people it is the right thing to give to others. Give of your time, give of yourself, give of your work, give of your money if you have it, as you see fit. I'm not telling you that I have the decision over your money or your time or your work. But I am saying give. In fact, in the Jewish tradition, there's a word called tzedakah. It's the closest word in Hebrew to charity. There is no word for charity because tzedakah also translates as your duty. And your duty is to be of service, to give, whether it's to honor God's creation or whether it's to give money to the poor or to help somebody learn or to heal someone, to help a child, to, you know, rescue a pet, to build something, to fix something. That's giving, and that's your duty as a human being if you're going to be a moral human being. So it's a good argument, and what the progressives have done is the statists, which is what they do to a lot of things. They take a basic core idea that's good and pervert one key part of it, just one, and that's all they need to do to turn it into a completely evil thing. They say now, and this is an argument that I was having with one of my family members, without divulging anybody else's confidence. In my extended family, there is a person married into family, and they have a relative who they're responsible for, and this relative has diminished capacities since birth, not going into the medical condition, but she has a number of medical conditions that cause her difficulty, and she can't get along by herself, so she has to be helped. And there's no question that her family has the duty to help her. In addition to that, there's no question that a lot of good people in this world do give to charities that help others that have medical conditions, no matter what they are. But I was having – I just posed a question to this family member of mine saying, hey, so you want to move them to this other facility and they have to enroll in a state and a federal program and then they have to wait so many months and then they get the funding. I said, and I looked up, the funding is going to cost a couple hundred thousand dollars. I said, how is it right that this particular branch of the family, which is a little bit more affluent than I am, maybe a lot more affluent, can ask others to do this against their will? They're not choosing to do this. And she said, well, first of all, we're not that affluent. And she explained it, and I see her point that she doesn't have hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the second point, though, was the progressive point, which is it's because people of this country agree that they want to help others. They want to do the right thing. And no one can argue with that, except for that key perverted thing, which says, and we're going to decide what that right thing is, and you don't have any say in whether you're going to give your money. Look, folks, there's an awful lot of good charities out there and a lot of good causes. You can choose to give your money. For instance, I know people who their big thing is saving animals, and that's a good thing. We are masters of this world, and here are these pets that are mistreated and abused, pit bulls and kitty cats out there that are, you know, they're not spayed, they're not neutered, they get no medical care, it's a bad thing, and we're responsible. Now, I'm very pleased when somebody goes and does something nice for these animals, and that's their choice, and I don't put them down at all. I don't tell them that my own personal view is that right now there are a lot more important things out there than taking care of the animals. There are people who do an awful lot of good trying to save babies, and this is so close to my heart, you know, with the abortion issue. And I don't tell them that if you don't focus solely on that right now, you might lift your head up and look at the fact that we're about to lose all sanctity of human life across the board, and they may be killing adults as well. No, I don't tell them that because that's their choice, and I could be wrong, and what they're doing is good. And there are people out there who will fight for property tax reform. That's a big fight going on in my state right now. You won't see it much in the press, but it's going on, and it's a big fight. And I tell them, look, you know, I don't like paying this property tax extortion. I think it's a bad thing. It drives low-income people out of their homes, older people, people on a fixed income. It's a scam to support crooked unions and bad schools that don't educate. But right now, we're in danger of losing all liberty and constitution statewide and nationally. What they're doing is an important fight, and it's their choice. And the nice thing is that every single one of these fights for all these good causes helps in general terms, and who knows which is going to be the one that gets that resonance with everybody else. It helps the entire movement move in the right direction towards liberty. So it's all good. But if it was up to me and I was the dictator and I got to say, look, you're going to help whether you like it or not, and this is how much you're going to help. I don't care if you can afford it or not. And you're going to help in this manner that I think is the most important way, and I don't care if you have any extra money to do that thing of your heart because I said it's not as important. And then what you end up with is the money going to a bureaucracy that doesn't really help much in the first place, and all those other causes that could be supported by people's individual desires to help being left as orphan causes that help nobody. And what you're left with is a lot of talk and not much real help at all. Look at what the federal government spends on. Look at the stuff that they say is nice. And then decide, and your state government, and your local government, and ask, is this really a decent expenditure of money? I mean, along a highway right near where I live, they got a grant from the federal government and a matching grant from the state, Community Development Block Grant, and this group on a multi-jurisdictional panel of these different townships and the county, and they said, we're going to build a path by the road, a path, mind you, for all these people to exercise on. It's a great idea. It's not a bad idea. And they spent a bunch of money basically tamping down a dirt path with some stone, which is already washed away a few years later. It's pretty much not there anymore. That's about it. And they spent, I'm not kidding you here, folks, on a six-mile path by a road that's just rocks and dirt crushed up and tamped down. They spent thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. It wasn't their money. It came a little bit from everywhere. It was money that they got free. I mean, if they didn't use it, somebody else was going to use it. And that's what you get. Because I'll tell you what, if they'd asked anyone around here who actually uses this, do you want a path? People might have gone, yeah, that's a great idea. Do you want to pay for a path? And they would have gone, you know, I'm wearing hiking boots. There's room by the side of the road there where the grass grows. I think I'll skip the path if I got to pay for it because it's not as important. Or maybe volunteers would have come out the way they do to clean up the highways around here, and they would have built a path. But some bureaucrat made a decision and took a whole bunch of money that came a little bit from Kelly's pocket and a little bit from Robert's pocket and a little bit from my pocket and everybody else, and Cindy, you paid too. You're never going to see that path, much less walk on it unless you come for a visit. But you paid for it. Actually, no. You know what? I just realized none of us paid for that because the money that they spent on that hasn't even been printed yet, hasn't been earned yet. Assuming that we restore liberty and restore prosperity, as Kelly was saying, which, and I believe we could do this, it's going to be years and years and years before the dollar is actually coined that pays for that path. And the path is already gone, so what was the point of that? Anyway, there's a little rant for you, see. Better let somebody else talk, though.
Look, while he was talking, I wrote a new bumper sticker.
What's it say?
Want to help people? ? Great! ! Give them your money, not your neighbor's.
Or mine.
I like that.
If this wasn't the daggum long, I don't know if that's going to happen. That goes all the way across the bumper.
Yeah, it's a little long.
Yeah, it is a little long. Maybe it takes two bumper stickers. I don't know.
Give them your, not mine.
Well,
is
I thought about
selfish?
That. Well, I that was my first edition, give them your money, not mine. Maybe that's a little too selfish on my part, putting
that's
it that
selfish.
Way. But it's yeah, but not your neighbors. It affects the whole community.
You know, here's a question for you. Is it selfish for me to decide for myself where I'm going to put my own efforts? Is it selfish for me to say, okay, and we're not talking about, by the way, folks, we're not talking about it's an emergency situation, a tornado just or a flood just swept through your town. People are desperate, and you've decided this would be a really good time. That's a little selfish, yeah. In those situations, you get out the rowboat and you start helping people out of the trees or, you know, pulling them out of the wreckage. But just ordinary times, regular times, there's no big emergency crisis right at this minute. Am I selfish to decide that I want to clean up this stream because I like fly fishing? I don't care if you like fly fishing. I'm cleaning it up because I like it and I want my kids to be able to fly fish there. Am I selfish to decide that, hey, for me, taking care of wounded warriors who got hurt for us is more important, even though the Veterans Administration spends a fortune and doesn't help them all that much? Is that selfish? Maybe it's selfish for me to say, hey, you know what? Instead of dumping a bucket of ice water on my head to give to a charity that hasn't solved anything and that uses stem cells from aborted fetuses, babies. Not that ALS isn't a serious cause, but is it selfish for me to say, no, I'm going to get on my Harley and I'm going to donate some money. We're going to go on a poker run, that's what we call them around here, to raise some money for one little kid who's got leukemia and would really like to see the medical bills covered for that poor family. Is that selfish? to help the way I want to help? I don't know.
Well,
maybe I'm selfish.
Well, actually, if you look at, you know, this is a stunning thing. You know, some liberal preachers will tell the congregation, oh, yeah, you know, we got to set up for the government and have liberal things and have socialism. But they haven't studied their Bible. In the Old Testament, there is no social security system, anything, because if you look at the Hebrew history, they lasted 600 to 800 years. The Torah was their charter or their constitution. The law was above the king. They started with judges, they went to kings. But, I mean, their political system is absolutely stunning when you look at it. There is no command where you have to give your money to the poor with a government-imposed penalty. In other words, you didn't give to the government gave it to the poor people. There was no structure of that allowed in God's system. Now, it does say that we are to help the poor, and anybody who doesn't, God will hold them personally accountable for sin. It's quite stunning. Like, wait. So, I am to help the poor and the needy and give no interest loans to my fellow Hebrews, if I was a Hebrew back then. But I'm not to give to the government to give to somebody else. That's what God's system that he set up. It's absolutely stunning when you have, I can't really call it political commentary by God, but you can see the Torah. You know, you tell them out to you that God didn't give Moses the Torah, they'll be very upset with you. But that was their political system. Again, there's no penalty. No penalty for not giving to the government to give to a poor person. And then, of course, some of the socialists would say, well, they had communism in the New Testament. Yeah. Everybody gave to whoever was in need. It's right there in the book of Acts. That was complete free will. There was no compulsion whatsoever. And no penalty. There certainly was never any penalty for somebody not willing to give. Well, Ananias and Sapphira, whoever it was? Well, they were killed because they didn't know. They lied. That's why they ended up dead. There was no penalty. But the socialists will say that, oh, yeah, communism in the New Testament. No, there wasn't. Because the money has to go from one hand to the government and then someone else. It's just...
Well, that's not communism. I mean, look, I hate to be a purist about this, but you are a very precise person in your speech as an engineer and a scholar. You rightly so.
Get a date.
Rightly so. You've corrected me in the past where I misspoke or misidentified or mislabeled something. This is something I cannot get through to people strongly enough. Liberals don't believe in statism because the people who believe in statism are by definition not liberals. Conservatives don't believe in statism because by definition they want to conserve the best of our heritage, not destroy it. They are not conservatives who support this massive state that takes away our liberty any more than the people who are allegedly liberals. Nor are the people who are true progressives who, you know, have brought a lot of good to the society. They are not statists either, and anyone who is a statist cannot be considered to be a progressive. The idea that there are people out there who know better than us and can decide for us is completely foolish. Everybody's looking for leadership. I heard this tonight at a meeting. We had like 80 people there, which is pretty good for the middle of farmland. Seriously, it's the middle of nowhere, miles from a city, 80 people. And people came from distances, some of them. I hear this all over. We need another Reagan, you know. The ones who really study history, we need another Washington. Look, I think that's great, and I'm more than willing to say, yeah, it'd be great to see more statesmen and stateswomen. But I'm not holding my breath. okay? There are very few leaders who are going to live up to that. And even somebody like a George Washington were to come on the scene, I wouldn't trust him, not as far as I could throw him. Even if he proved over and over and over again he was trustworthy, that his decisions were worthwhile, I would never just willingly go to sleep and say, okay, you decide, I'll just do whatever you tell me. No, and as a matter of fact, anyone who reads history at all will look and see that even George Washington was constantly questioned. People, and he made mistakes. He was an honorable man. He didn't make that ultimate mistake of grabbing power. He turned down power. That's the most amazing thing. But people questioned him the whole time. And he didn't say, well, you know what? You've questioned me, and I have an army in back of me. I'm going to just grab you up and close your presses down and shut up your newspaper, and maybe we'll lock you up. Maybe we'll murder you and call it official, call it legal. No, he wasn't a Hitler. He wasn't a King George. He wasn't a despot. And if Reagan came back, somebody who is just an amazing communicator who gets it, who can bring everything down to the simplest, clearest level, who can express things in a way that the other side just can't even answer. Do you think that we would be right to just go, well, there he goes again. Let's just do whatever he tells us. There is no Messiah. This is what people think that maybe – I'm not talking religion here. All right, maybe there is a Messiah, and I believe he's coming, and some believe he's already been here and he's coming back, and that's all wonderful. But short of that, and believe me, folks, if that were to happen, I think we'll all know. But short of that, regular folks are not Messiahs. Your boss, if you have the best boss in the world, it's going to screw up sometimes. In your family, whoever is responsible for, whatever it is, it's going to mess up sometimes. A bill's going to be late. Something's going to be left out in the rain. Something's going to be left out to get stepped on. People mess up. When they have more power, they have more chance to mess up. When they're tempted, there's more chance that they're going to willingly mess up or get seduced into messing up. Don't expect perfection. When you meet somebody who you think is a good leader, check them out. If they are a good leader, support them. And continue to question them. Unquestioned obedience is the hallmark of statism. That is the hallmark of dictators and kings. You could not question King George without getting in deep, deep trouble. You cannot question the Ayatollahs and the mullahs in Afghanistan or in Iran today, or you're in deep trouble. If you're in North Korea today and you question dear leader, you're in deep trouble. Your family's in deep trouble. Everyone you ever knew, met, smelled, touched, stood next to is in trouble. If you criticized Adolf Hitler, you were dead. I criticize people in power. They should get used to it. They should expect it. If they're any good at all, they should welcome it. And I have met a few. Over the years, who are strong enough in their ego to be able to say, yeah, I can be an important guy, I can be in the center of attention, I can have all this pressure on me, and I can stand up to that. That's good. But even fewer who have the humility to say, and I'm no more important ultimately than the least of my constituents, that every single one of them has a point that the least educated, least intelligent, least experienced one among them might be seeing things better than I am on any particular issue, so I better listen and not act like a jerk. And there's a few out there, and they're starting to move up the ranks. You're probably not going to find too many of them in Washington, D.C. You might find a few of them in your state capital. But I'll bet you anything, if you look in your everyday life, and look around your community, you probably know a half a dozen of them. Maybe more. And it's our own fault that those people are still in our local community and not in our state capitals and in Washington, because we need to convince them that they need to do it. Then we need to help them get there, because they're not going to do it on their own. And quite frankly, I think most people who are really suited for the office don't want it. Lord knows I don't want it. I don't think any of you do. Would you want to be president? Would any one of you want to sit in that Oval Office and have to deal with that? Any one of you? What a horrible job.
I must say I've got mixed thoughts on that.
Well, but I would vote for you.
Actually, when I was younger, I considered running for office. But,
well, you know, Dan,
like city council or something.
I'd like to get more Robert's thoughts because I like his knee-jerk reaction and mixed feelings. Because if a person is seriously thinking of themselves as the president, simultaneously, if they're a decent person, they would be thinking, "Oh my gosh, that's a lot of faithfulness. A lot of work, a lot of diligence, a lot of headache." They're counting the cost in their head to be a good president, which should yield, as Robert said, it should yield mixed feelings. I mean, yeah, there'll be lots of glory involved, but, you know, feed your ego, all that junk. But to really do a good job, and that's probably why a lot of good men, women don't want the job, because they are thinking of others and the heavy burden if they do run for office, and so they shy away.
No, I agree. You literally have people's lives in your hands the higher you get up the ladder. And the higher you get up there, the more lives that, you know, that you can affect for good or ill. And as Dan pointed out, you know, nobody's perfect. So, you know, that definitely is a lot of pressure, because things that you do, you know, affect a lot of people. So, you know, you want to be able to do what's right for them. But unfortunately, you know, I think it's to a point where you get somebody, you know, good in there, and then, you know, all the others kind of surround them and say, "Look, pal, you're, or gal, you're not going to last very long with that type of attitude." And, you know, if you want to make any kind of difference, you know, you have to play by our rules, play by our games. And if not, I mean, you're out, and perhaps even all the way out, if you guys know what I mean.
You know, I've been fortunate. I try and look at the reason why I'm going through what I'm going through in my life. All of you should be examining your own lives for lessons, and I probably you are. And I'm thinking to myself specifically, why am I still stuck in the unemployment office all this time? Why is it that nobody has just come out of the blue and said, "Dan, you know, I got this great job for you," or, you know, "Why haven't I hit the lottery?" or something, you know, something where I can go full-time, full bore with this liberty thing and use all those talents that God gave me for just that and not my day job. And so I'm trying to figure this out. And, of course, I'm rationalizing, well, you know, and maybe I'm not as good as you know, people say I am, or I think maybe I am. Maybe I need to learn something. And I thought, okay, well, what is it that I'm stuck there learning? And it just hit me that I've actually had a really good example. I'm not mentioning any names here. I've been passed over for promotion how many times I don't even apply anymore, because they kept picking people who would go along, people who would say yes, people who would just not question at all. Questioners, much less disobedient people, they want people who just do what they're told. And I'm not one of those guys. Which is fine. So they put these people in place, and these are nice people. These are good people. They work hard. And I watch them. And I'm thinking about it. I've been watching them. How do they cope with this? And it's exactly what Robert said and what Kelly said. It's exactly that. They start to get a little bit out of the mold and start to ask questions, maybe make some waves, and the next thing you know, they're threatened. And at the same time as they're being threatened, they're being offered something nice if they go along. Now, nobody's threatening their lives or their families, but, hey, it's a job, and do you really want to have to go to a job with major stress and get yelled at every day? Most people can't deal with that. Well, there's one particular person who is really smart, and this person works their butt off, and they know. It's amazing how much information they have. And they've been ambitious. I won't even mention the gender, but this person has been moving their way up the ladder. And I've been watching them every step of the way. And they're pretty high up now. Started the same place I did. And as they've been going along, they've been going along to get along.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been rationalizing it. You know, the only way I'm going to get there is so I can do good is by going along with this very minor little evil. It's a little thing they want me to do. All right, they want me to break a rule. No, they want me to mess with somebody. Oh, they want me to give that other person a pass. Oh, they want me to promote their friend. Well, these aren't the worst things in the world, so I'll do them. And then when I get there, I'll be able to do good. But every single thing that they've done along the way like that has diminished their character, their inner reserve of strength, their resolve. It's diminished them as a person. And now that they're at a point where they can really start to really make some positive changes, they're not looking at positive changes. And every single person, me, I'm kind of the guy who questions all the time, grief, nothing but grief. How dare you question? Don't you see I'm trying to do the right thing? No, you're not. You're not doing the right thing. All you do is anytime someone questions, you get mad at them and give them grief. And I have noticed that this person is starting to use the wrong techniques on purpose. Nobody is guiding them anymore. They don't need to be guided to pick on somebody else's enemies because they're looking at people who aren't going along and saying, you're my enemy. And they're picking on people. And they've got friends. They've got people who kiss up to them. And they're helping them. Nobody's telling them, hey, you know, you want to get someplace, you got to help my friends. No. They've adopted this technique. I've reminded people before of one of my boyhood heroes, Duke Cunningham, and how he went wrong. This was a guy who was an Eagle Scout and went to Annapolis and a Navy aviator and took a phantom jet, a flying brick, a missile interceptor, and turned it into a dogfighting machine, mounted guns on the bomb pods, you know, Gatling guns, went up with his wingman down 5 highly maneuverable and agile MiGs over the Gulf of Tonkin and, you know, right over Hanoi and helped set up the Top Gun school for naval aviators. Just an amazing guy, comes back, starts a business, makes legitimate money, does really good, gets convinced to run for Congress. Runs for Congress. He's a good congressman. This is an excellent guy. But he was going along, and he was going along to get along, and something was diminished in him. I don't know what it was that started it. I don't know all the steps of the way. They never came out with that information, and he's never written a memoir. But my hero, this fighter ace, when they caught him, then put him in prison. He had sold a $100 million defense contract for a yacht. They didn't start off selling our national defense and tax money for personal gain. He started off with something less. He helped somebody do something wrong so he could get somewhere. So any of you who managed or find yourself in a position of influence and power
in the world. Were you talking about John McCain?
No, this isn't John McCain. John McCain is a special case. John McCain is a guy who never started off at the right place in the begin with. He is the son of royalty. His father was an admiral. He went to Annapolis. His father was an admiral. He was the worst kid in his class. He almost destroyed a ship he was on. He has been nothing but trouble for the United States military and for his compatriots. There's few, if any, who served with him who will even speak to him. He's a guy who can say the right thing at the right time and look like he's a real, real patriotic American. And a big part of why ISIS is getting strong right now, a big part of that is because he armed them. So, either he's really, really, really confused or he's just a bad guy.
Actually, he was on... Yeah, and he was on CNN tonight for their commentary, and he was kind of bantering back and forth with Obama's old press secretary about ISIS.
I missed the news tonight. I haven't had a chance, but somebody was telling me from their smartphone or thing that, what, did Obama declare war again tonight on his own? Did he just decide that he's going to take our tax money and arm some more Muslim fundamentalist terrorists so that they can turn them against us? Is that what happened?
Well, from my understanding, he's going to go to Congress and see if they'll, you know, come aboard.
Kind of trying to put the full court press on before the elections so that he can look like he's a real strong leader, and that if Congress says no, that they're really not patriotic. Is that it?
I just got little snippets of the the press conference that Obama had, and then I got a little bit of the commentary while I was eating dinner, you know, for it. So I only really got it about maybe 15 minutes of it. And that wasn't even a speech, but just some of the commentary.
The really sad thing is that if we had decent leaders, we really would have to watch their speeches and read the laws and try and figure out, you know, are they 100% right? Are they partly right? Where is the mistake? Where is the thing that we like to see included or not included in the bill? But anymore, from almost all of them, you barely even have to, like, check the Yahoo or Google or Drudge Report or even Huffington. You know, you rarely even have to look at any news. You hear a headline, you go, yeah, I know what it's about. I know exactly what they're going to do, what they're going to say, and their justifications and what the real reasons are and what the response is going to be from the mainstream press and from the rhinos and from the Democrats. And try this, folks. Just try being cynical. And try just saying, let's say there's a pattern, and just for a couple of days, when you see a headline, before you read the story, just jot a few notes to yourself as to what you think they're doing, to see if you've got a good handle on a pattern, and to see if they're being honest with you. If they're being honest with you, you will not be able to predict what the story's about from a headline. You will not be able to tell, make conclusions. Honest people deal with reality. Reality is strange. It requires research. You have to think about it. If, on the other hand, you're lying for a point and you're just trying to promote some alternate secret agenda, then it's real easy to predict it. See if you're accurate, folks. If you're accurate, congratulations, you have figured out a pattern. And isn't that sad? Isn't that sad that you've already figured out what the lie is that your leaders are telling you and why they're actually doing it?
And Cindy, we haven't heard from you for a bit, so I'm going to go ahead and open up the mic. And then you mentioned Strange, and perhaps give us more information about what you were doing with Draw Strange. Or yes, if pointed out was on our show a couple of weeks ago. Before that, I want to bring it back over to you, Cindy.
I didn't understand what you wanted me to comment on. What did you want me to say?
Oh, just maybe some of the, you know, different things that Dan was discussing.
Oh, well, Dan's always right.
Oh, no. No.
I can't argue with Dan. I want to go back to something you were saying before, because there is one thing involved in the philosophy of giving and charity, and that is that it is voluntary. As soon as you take the voluntary out of charity, it's no longer charity, it's theft. And so what our government has done is they have taken $80 to spend $20 on helping somebody, when if we as the church, we as individuals, even secular charity organizations, we could do it so much cheaper, because we base most of our giving on our programs on voluntary labor, and So we would spend so much less money in order to give charity to people. And I look at, well, let's take World Vision, for instance. I used to have a couple of World Vision children that I supported. And World Vision would send out every year a little circle graph showing where the money went. It would go so much for advertising to try to get more people, and so much for administration, and then so much for, you know, actual projects. And there, the government, the United States government, whereas they take 80% of your money to do 20% worth of good, it was almost exactly the opposite with World Vision. They would take 20% of your money to administer 80% that would go to actual helping projects. And see, it's so much more efficient to have us doing it ourselves. And I resent that the government has taken that out of our hands and taken a blessing away from us, because we get a blessing for that. But now they have taken so much of my money that I can no longer afford to do anything except pay my taxes. We're paying tens of thousands of dollars in taxes, and 80% of that is total waste through administration costs, fraud, misappropriation, you name it, okay, kickbacks. So that tells me I've lost my blessing. I have also, now we are failing to help the people that really need help, and I am helping people who don't need help, able-bodied people who need to go out and work for themselves. I'm helping them. When you do charity work in your neighborhood, in your own community, you know exactly who needs it, and you know who is lying and who's not, and who's faking and who's not, who really can support themselves and who can't. And that you, at the ground level, looking a person in the eye, knowing what their life is and knowing what their situation is, that's the correct person to help. And that's what God set up. That's what he set up as our, like Kelly was talking about, how the Jewish people, the Hebrew people of the glory days, that's how they were set up, to give voluntarily to your neighbor because you knew what your neighbor needed. And the government, it had very few responsibilities, to tell you the truth. Even when they had a king, the king had very few responsibilities as far as, you know, taking care of the people was concerned. They were supposed to, you know, maintain the army and, really the priests did most of the work as far as enforcing the law and stuff like that. I mean, so I don't know. It just boggles the mind what people have allowed to happen. And part of that is because of good old Madeline Murray O'Hare, who took God and the Bible out of our classrooms, out of our public life, and pretty much we've had several generations of people now come through public school with no knowledge of who God is. Their parents aren't teaching them at home. And even if their parents are teaching them, or if they've gone to church, they don't get any reinforcement from anywhere else. So they think their parents are nuts. You know, where did our parents get this idea? You know, and so the community as a whole does not say to people, "There's a God that we have to be accountable to." Okay, and so when there's no God to be accountable to, the only person you're accountable to is the human law. Well, you can see that there's plenty of smart people out there. They're just tearing up human law. I mean, they can get away with Chappaquiddick. I mean, there is just nothing above. There's nothing beyond what they're able to. They're smart enough to get over, or rich enough to get over. So, when we start turning over our money to people like that, and expect them to give charity, that's a farce. That is an absolute ludicrous proposition. And yet, people think they're doing a great thing. I mean, there was that guy on Republicans, Libertarians, Democrats Facebook page that I get on there sometimes. Guy came on from Ohio. I think I told you this, Robert. Guy came on from Ohio saying how proud he was of their welfare system and how they help people that need help. And I'm like, okay, he thinks that his tax money is going to help those people. He has no clue that his tax money was 80% of it wasted. And the rest, we're really not sure about.
Well, you know, Cindy, no, go ahead.
No, I was basically finished, so go ahead.
Oh, okay. The idea that we have to know our neighbor and where the money's going specifically isn't necessary to good charity. And the idea that there's never going to be waste with private organizations isn't necessarily true. Here's you know, and there are greater minds than mine who have thought about this stuff. There's a guy named Moses Maimonides. He lived in Islamic Spain, of all places, back when the caliphate was not trying. You know, they were in their glory days. They'd conquered. They were not conquering anymore. This is about 1100, you know, about the time of the Norman conquest, a little after that. And he lived in Spain, in Cordoba, and he was a scholar of the Talmud, of the commentaries about the law. You know, because for years there's been a conversation of rabbis. Rabbi doesn't mean holy man. It just means a teacher, somebody who really thinks and tries to teach to others, which has gone on over generations, where one will discuss what somebody else has discussed. And a lot of it's legalistic. And there was a famous argument. This kind of tells you what it's about, where the Ten Commandments says you keep the Sabbath day holy. So it was a big argument about, are you permitted to do any work on the Sabbath? And it came out that if, and this is also by Maimonides, Rambam, as he was called, that if there's somebody who falls down a well, or even an animal that falls down a well, and it's the Sabbath, you're going to do work to drag that animal or that person out of the well, because that's obeying God's greater commandment, which is to honor his creation and to be good to others, even if it's the Sabbath. And that's the kind of work that would be permitted. Well, he came up with a list of rules for charity. You know, he said, all right, what is the best way to give? It's all good. And he said that the worst way to give was to go to your neighbor who needs shoes and go, you know what? You need shoes. Come with me. Let's go to the store and get you some shoes. And you drag him to the store, and you say, I'm buying him shoes. And you go out of the store and say, look, everybody, I just bought him shoes. See, aren't I a great guy? Now, are you helping him? Yeah. Is it charity? Absolutely. It's not really the highest form of charity. And the higher forms are to give in a more anonymous fashion, and to give in a way that's, you know, maybe more deeply involved with solving the problem in the first place. I mean, he's still poor. He's got shoes, but he's still poor. And the highest form of charity, the second highest, was to give to a trusted intermediary. So you know somebody, a civic leader, a rabbi, a minister, a priest, a doctor, somebody who you really trust, and you say, look, here, take this money, this food, this clothing, and don't tell me who you're giving it to, but when you find somebody who's needy, who really can benefit, give it to them, And don't tell him it came from me. So you could walk down the street, and there's some guy wearing shoes, and you bought the shoes, but you don't know it, and they don't know it. But the very highest, highest, highest form was to take someone in your community and help them become self-sufficient, to teach them how to be a better person in terms of coping with the world, whatever that is. We give them a skill, get them a job, something where they can actually start supporting themselves and join that charitable giving place. You know, there are people right now who don't have jobs. They don't have any money to give. If they have jobs, if prosperity is recreated in this country, then they've got the option to give. And if we're doing this privately without the coercion of government taxes, there will be charities that take your money and rip you off. And there'll be charities that take your money and waste it. And when those are found out, and it's our job to look into those, it's the news media's job, it's the government's job to make sure there's no fraud. But when they find out, you find out that, hey, remember after 9/11 when there was all those concerts and we all cried and we all chipped in whatever we could, you know, 10 bucks, 50 bucks, whatever it was, 100 bucks. Some people had money more, and they sent it to this for the 9/11 families, and we're like, oh, yeah, that's it. I feel good. And then it turned out that they never gave a dime to these families. Remember when we gave to the Red Cross for 9/11? And they kept the money and earned interest on it and didn't spend it and said it's for other things, even though they'd asked for a specific thing. Remember when we found out that the director of the Red Cross at the time, and I love the Red Cross, and it's a great thing to you know, do the blood banks and all. That's wonderful. Help when there's a fire in the neighborhood, bring blankets and coffee and give them a place to stay. This is a good thing. But we found out that the director of the Red Cross at the time was making a six-figure salary and had hired their wife with a six-figure salary and their daughter with a six-figure salary and their son-in-law with a six-figure salary. And we said, we're not going to give them any money. That's it. We've had it with you guys. And the board of directors of the Red Cross, who had been laying down the job, said, okay, we're going to get rid of this guy and his whole family, and we're going to spend the money on what we agreed to spend the money on, and we're going to really clean up our ship. And they did, and now we can give money to them and feel pretty good because they're using it the way we're giving it, what we're giving it for. So, you know, it's not that there won't be waste or fraud. It's just that when we catch it, we can stop doing it. Try not paying your taxes. People have done this. They've said, I don't support unjust wars. I don't support this crazy socialist scheme. I'm going to give my taxes only to what's in the Constitution. I'm going to prorate it out and say, this is what's required for you to establish a vigorous national defense and provide for regulation of interstate commerce that's really interstate commerce. And we're going to, and just those few things that the federal government's supposed to do, and that's all I'm giving. And then see what happens when they padlock your property, because they have the force to do that. By the way, the IRS doesn't need a warrant to do that. And they can also seize your bank account, and they don't need a warrant to do that. They don't have to go to a judge. And they can garnish your wages.
Actually, they do.
Well, no, you mean correctly and properly they do.
No, actually, it's
terms.
Law now. Traffic can't. 97 or 98, Trafficant required the burden of proof. Yeah, required the burden of proof upon the IRS. It took seizures, like, I don't know, what was it, like 5,000 homes down to 50 a year. Bank accounts,
you know,
like 10,000 down to like 150. The burden of proof is now on the IRS. That's what's stunning about it.
Well, wait a minute. That you're assuming that they're going to follow the law and that anything's going to happen to them if they don't.
That's what I'm saying. Although they still have the power, per se, they don't have
the
authority to do
what
they're doing.
These are the same people who were involved in going after True the Vote and constitutional organizations and the Tea Party and haven't been called to account for it. The same ones. There's a story out of Philadelphia, and this isn't the IRS, but it's the same idea of coercion. There's a family, owns a home. Their son got in trouble. He was selling $40 worth of drugs. It's illegal. I don't know if it should be illegal. Probably not. But he was selling $40 worth of drugs, and he got caught, and he got in trouble. And because of that, there's a civil forfeiture law where the family's house was seized, and now their house is guilty because the house was charged, not them. They weren't charged with anything, but the house, since he lived there, was charged, and the house can't defend itself. So they have to go to court, petition the court to represent the house and to say on behalf of the house that it shouldn't be seized by the Philadelphia Police Department and sold so that they can buy themselves, I don't know what the hell they're buying themselves, tanks, something like that. Mm-hmm. That the abuses happen because they can get away with it. That one of the first scandals of the Obama administration was Fast and Furious, where they were taking, making gun dealers. They were threatening these gun dealers. You will break the law. They're going to say you're going to, when these guys come in, and they want to buy multiple guns, and they don't want to have any good ID, and you think they're from Mexico, you're just going to sell it to them without any paperwork, and just let them have it. And they took these guns. They went to Mexico. They murdered Border Patrol agents. They murdered Mexican citizens. Any number of crimes. They murdered Mexican officials. And nobody's been called to account for it. They all got raises. Back at Ruby Ridge, going back, 15, 20 years now, the sniper who murdered the woman holding her baby, Randy Weaver's wife, the cop in the woods, the federal cop who shot the son, the 16-year-old boy, the guy who masterminded this, they all got raises. They got promotions. Everybody involved gets a pat on the back and a pass. They don't follow the law. The law means nothing to them. Just like you were telling us, Kelly, that they've perverted the grand jury system to a point where unless the attorney general signs off on it, it's not going to happen. So you can't go after the attorney general. He just won't sign off on it.
About Ruby Ridge, the Idaho Department of Justice put out an arrest warrant for the federal agents who did that crap. I'm not sure
I would like to see those people serve serious state time for that. That's murder.
Well, I'd like to see them get the death penalty.
Well, I'm sorry, but pro-life is pro-life. Exigent circumstances of war or crime, somebody's threatening my life, I'll take theirs if I have to, and I don't want to do it, but I'll do what I have to do and live with it. But short of that, I don't want to have the government execute anybody. And the reason is because no matter how heinous it seems, no matter how guilty they are, life in proper prison is more of a punishment, and the government gets it wrong too often. They've gotten it wrong on so many things. There's so many cases of prosecutorial misconduct. I wouldn't take the chance because you can never, ever make it right.
When I say that,
death sentence. I'm in a little bit of disagreement. That's why I don't call myself so much as pro-life as I am anti-abortion because, I do support the death penalty personally. People go, "Oh, you're pro-life." I'm like, "Nah, I wouldn't say that," because a lot of folks, like you, Dan, put the capital punishment in there as well with, within pro-life. And so, just kind of a little disclaimer to that. That's why, I consider myself anti-abortion more so than the pro-life. But go ahead, Kelly.
Well, I find it interesting when somebody tries to tell me what my convictions are, pro-life and at the same time pro-death sentence for murderers. The government agents, they are held to a higher standard. They have two sets of laws they have to follow, government agents do. One, of course, all the regular laws that are passed by the legislatures that all the citizens have to follow, don't murder, don't steal, don't rape, blah, blah, blah. All right, the second set of laws is basically the Constitution and the liberties that brought forth the Constitution. It's really, government agents are held to a higher standard. So I would have no problem when a government agent killed somebody like that woman at Ruby Ridge, and I would move to get him death sentence immediately. Assuming all the evidence is solid, because with the death penalty, that's a very delicate situation, because if they maliciously prosecute someone who is innocent, but they make him guilty, the state has blood, innocent blood on their hands, and that is not good. So that's kind of where I'm coming from with that. Government and government getting out of control. When there would be a death sentence, you know, the Nuremberg trial is obviously a big deterrent to anybody in any country that wants to kill people. Oh, I was just following orders. Well, that's fine. Now we're going to put you to death, Nuremberg trial. So, you know, the it's a huge deterrent. The death penalty is a huge deterrent. California still has it, by the way. And I think we just executed a woman, one of the first women in like a long, long time. Anyway, that's just my view of the death penalty. I got a redneck buddy. He's kind of funny. You know, rednecks are pretty straight up. You know, why the hell? He talked about hangings at a big public event. And he went to one, I believe, as a kid, late 60s. Everybody from the community would come, and they'd have make a picnic out of it, and then they'd hang the people. Then everybody would go home. But it certainly showed the kids, respect the law, you'll end up like these guys. And I've got there's a picture in a local bar of the last hanging in California. And, I mean, it's kind of gruesome to see, I think, 5 or 6 men hanging from a tree. But the question is, of course, due process rights, you don't want to have an innocent person be killed. That's not an excuse, per se, for eliminating the death sentence. It is a good argument, though, because the state does not want innocent blood on its hands. And the nice thing about the conviction in our country is that the death penalty, the final verdict is by a jury. So you have to convince 12 people. And, of course, you can have malicious prosecutors and wrongful evidence, and there's still appellate systems available.
Well, I'll tell you what. First of all, I want to commend Robert because, once again, we've proven that precise speech and labeling does make a difference. And Robert, saying you're anti-abortion versus saying you're pro-life is an entirely clear position. And I appreciate the fact that you can hold those two views and express it in a completely clear and unarguable position. I mean, you can argue with the position itself, but you can't argue that you have this position and you've been honest about how you feel, that you're against murdering innocent babies. But not necessarily against taking the lives of those who have been convicted of heinous crimes after due process. I get that. Now, a little story. My great aunt, who's passed away since now, lived a good long life. She was a lawyer. She was one of the first lady lawyers in Philly, Philadelphia lawyer, and first president of the Judicial Bar Review. So she was keeping judges clean as much as possible. And back in the 80s, she was already semi-retired and still had a law firm, still was doing very well. And she heard about this DNA evidence that was starting to come out, DNA, looked into it and found that it was pretty amazing stuff. Now, it wasn't as advanced as it is today, but it was pretty damn good stuff. So she took a bunch of students from the Temple and University of Pennsylvania law schools who were working as interns for her, and they started an innocence project, and they went to the prisons in Pennsylvania, the state prisons, and they said, look, if you're convicted of a crime that involved a person, okay, not a financial crime or a crime of theft or any of that stuff, but something that involved a person where there's a possibility of DNA evidence. And she had them explain to them what the DNA is, that you have a unique little feature inside each one of your cells that is just you and nobody else. And it can't be anyone but you if it's your DNA, and it can't be you if it's somebody else's DNA. And she says, I am willing free, pro bono, you don't have to come up with any money, to take your case as far as it needs to go to get you cleared. How many of you want me to go and try and clear you on this new DNA evidence? And from what she told me, she says like 98% of these people, these convicted felons, raised their hand. Oh, yeah, I want that. And she said, before I ask you to sign anything, I'm going to ask for another show of hands. And I want you to understand that I believe in the law. I think most of you are probably guilty. And that if you're guilty, I would love to see you serve out your entire sentence with no parole. So here's the deal. If you say that you're innocent and you want me to try and get our experts at great cost to go over this DNA evidence and see if you're the one who committed that rape or that murder or that assault or not, that's fine. And if I do that and I find out through the experts that you were not the guy, we're going to do everything just like I promised, come hell or high water, to get your name cleared and to get you know, another look at the case, or get you pardoned, get it thrown out, get you out of prison. And they're cheering her. And she waited for the cheers to drop, you know, to die down. And she says, and if it turns out that the DNA evidence proves that you're the one who did it, that you did that heinous crime, she says, I come from a very long-lived family, and I have students here who are 40 and 50 years younger than me who are also going to live a long time, and we're pledging that every single time you come up for a parole hearing, we're going to bring that DNA evidence to the parole board, and if they make a mistake and decide to let you out anyway, we're going to go to their bosses and to the press and highlight the feature that they're letting go somebody who is clearly guilty. So keep in mind that if you are guilty, we're going to make sure you never get out. Now, how many of you want me to help? And about 10% raised their hands. Now, in a lot of these cases, because she did as she promised, in a lot of these cases, the evidence was inconclusive. The samples were too old or too degraded. They weren't enough to prove anything. But literally hundreds of men who were in jail for serious, heinous crimes, it was proven that they didn't commit that crime. Were they bad guys before? Had they done other things? Who knows? That's not what they were on trial for. They were not on trial for being a bad guy, and you might as well convict him because he might have done other things in the past. Or he's just a, look at him. Look at him. He's a bad dude. He's got shifty eyes. He's the wrong skin color. He's the wrong whatever it is. He's uneducated. He's mean. He's cruel. Maybe, maybe not. And who cares? If you're accused of a crime, it's the burden of the state to prove you committed that crime. And she found hundreds who had not committed the crime that they were convicted of and who were let go. And most of them did not reoffend even after having been to prison and been degraded in that manner. So I'm going to stay with pro-life.
It sounds good, Dan, I mean, that you've, you know, gone through all that. But, you know, there's definitely, I think it's a No, I definitely think it's a deterrent. I think that, you know, if we're going to be statistic-wise, we, you know, go through the whole gamut, I think. And I'm not saying there hasn't been mistakes, and I'm sure there has been. I believe there's even been, you know, there's even proof out there saying that there, you know, evidence comes up after the fact. You know, however, I would say the vast majority of the folks who that did happen to, you know, got what was coming to them, in my opinion.
Well, I'm with you, Robert.
Go ahead,
I'm with you. I think that I'm also anti-abortion. I agree with the death penalty because God provides for it. But the thing is, you have to remember this. There must be two eyewitnesses. According to the requirements in the scriptures, in the Torah, there must be two eyewitnesses to the murder. Now, these days we're using DNA as one of the witnesses. I suppose I can go with that. If it is ever shown that mistakes can be made in that area, then I would say no, that the DNA cannot be an eyewitness. But there's also another qualification, and that is that the punishment of death needs to be for death. You know, the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth instruction means that you don't kill somebody for punching somebody in the face or, you know, whatever. You know, the punishment has to fit the crime. And so only cases of premeditated murder, first degree, and possibly even second degree, depending. But those are the only crimes that you can take someone's life for. I know that there's been some argument about that because of historically there have been other. I mean, people used to hang people for stealing a horse. You know. they were a little looser with their hangmen back in the old days and different times throughout history. But the Bible is clear that it's eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. So,
well, hold on to that one. That's a very commonly misquoted scripture.
I understand that it's dealing with a specific occurrence where two men are fighting, they bump into a woman and a pregnant woman and something happens. And so I do believe that that's what God intends throughout. I mean, you have to look at what he says about some law, one law, and you have to sort of bring that over, because he didn't do specific. He did not write, a 6-foot stack of laws to cover every single little detailed occurrence that could happen. Crimes. There's so many crimes out there; it's ridiculous. But you're not going to. Every single crime is not dealt with. You have to deal in generalities sometimes with the Bible. And generally speaking, the way I read the Bible, the punishment has to fit the crime. You know, whatever the person has done, then there's a certain crime, a certain punishment for that, or a restitution of some sort.
Well, I can't wait to open up about it because it's a fascinating system. The whole system, the Hebrew system, is absolutely stunning and fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, they're kind of like we have the Fifth Amendment, which you read the Fifth and then into the Sixth. It takes it from time of crime, indictment, to due process, cross-examination, right to counsel, then trial by jury. It's fascinating how our Fifth and Sixth describe quite a bit the legal process to put somebody in jail. The Hebrew system, I did not see. There's some things missing in the Hebrew system. One, there's no instructions for attorneys. When Christ walked the earth, he condemned the teachers of the law, the lawyers, you know, the lawyers. But there is no instructions for attorneys whatsoever. There is no jails, I find in Scripture. Now, this, I'll get back to this. But the system was very dynamic, depending upon the judges. And when they had a situation where they couldn't figure out what to do, they were to go, this is Deuteronomy 16, 17, and 19, they were to go to the chief priests. It was very much arguably like a grand jury. It was too hard. The judge was to go to the chief priests. I believe the elders, like the Sanhedrin, when they condemned Christ, it was very much like a grand jury. You had the elders, the teachers of the law, you had the judges, and then the chief priests. You had a whole group of people trying to figure out what the truth is. They didn't have jail. It was pretty harsh. If you stole a cow, you had to pay back five cattle. If you couldn't sell the five, if you couldn't come up with five to pay for the one you stole, you would be sold for slave for 7 years. Now, what does that do? A third party buys you as a slave for 7 years, but you got to go home every night to your wife and your kids. Our system, just throw them in jail, and you got a lot of fatherless kids, and they repeat, repeat, repeat. 80% of the inmates in prison didn't have a kid, or didn't have a father figure in their life. But the Hebrew system, the father could see their kids every day. So there was, it's something interesting. Now, you had the death penalty, or if you couldn't pay back for your crime or restitution, you'd be sold as a slave. Which, you know, people say, oh, there's slavery in the Bible. You bet. It's a better system than our prison system is, because that system didn't have repeat offenders. Think what the kids would learn. But that one of the basis of their, oh, by the way, they had judges in every small town. We used to have that in America. You know, these stupid civil suits, McDonald's cups too hot, spills on your lap, you get awarded $2 million. In a small town judge, they would have said, get out of my courtroom. And in America, you have to be an attorney and be followed by the, you have to know all the law and the procedure. I mean, God in the Torah, he didn't write the rules of evidence, the rules of criminal procedure, rules of civil procedure, rules of local court. And then once you know all that, you might know the ropes when you're in court. Then you've got case law. Then you've got the statutes at large that define the penalty for the crime and this and that. It's insane how much was put together in the American system and how it's grown like crazy. The Hebrew system, it was quite up to the judge. Now, here's one of the tenets. This is Deuteronomy 19. This is where eye for eye, tooth for tooth comes from. It's actually having to do with perjury. It says, one witness is not enough to convict a person of a crime or offense they may have committed, but only upon the testimony of two or three witnesses. The judge must make a thorough investigation. If a malicious witness is found, the defendant shall do to the plaintiff what the plaintiff intended to do to the defendant. And though such a wicked thing, which means like a lie, malicious witness, such a wicked thing will not be found in Israel. Show no mercy. In the Bible it says show no mercy. Show no mercy. Eye for eye, life for life, tooth for tooth. The penalty for perjury, if you're trying to frame somebody, let's say have them put to death by, you know, somebody that, you know, person A and person B, person A just hates person B, tries to frame them, tries to get him killed. And guess what? Person A will now be killed because he lied. I mean, malicious witness is way up. It's way past lying. Lying is, you know, it could be a small fib, it could be a big point, bold-faced lie. There's so many business. But a malicious witness is somebody who uses the court system to set up and retaliate against somebody else. It's a very precise term. And God is saying, hey, look, you find somebody, kill them, because we need to have truth in our courts. Eye for eye, life for life, truth for truth. That's a penalty for perjury. In California, it's 2 years. No big deal, you know. Even if they don't even force perjury very much in California, unless it's a political enemy of the district attorney. I mean, it's a completely different system, and it's stunning. King Jehoshaphat went all throughout Israel and appointed judges all over, but also there was an appellate case. Samuel, the prophet Samuel, he was also a judge. He wrote a three-town circuit court, appellate court. That's where we get that from. But when you have a rule of law, there's two things essential for a country to be prosperous. One is to have a charter above the king, when the law is above the king. Great Britain had that from the Magna Carta. America had that from a constitution. Look, we became phenomenally prosperous. The Hebrews had a charter, or the law above everybody, and they had that. So two things that make, assuming it's a good charter, but two things that make for liberty and prosperity is, one is a charter, the other is a charter that's actually enforced and followed. And so that if you look at the history of the Hebrews, their wealth and renown rival that of the Greeks and Romans. It's not taught in the public schools or anything like that, but I've done some research on this, and their prosperity was just absolutely stunning.
because of the simple idea of a charter and enforcing a charter.
And one other thing that's amazing is how time flies, and we've only got a few more minutes before I have to close things out for this evening. So we'll be looking forward to next week on the show, and it's Wednesday at 10. So what I'll have to do is start taking some closing comments, and then I'll be closing things out for the evening. And so first we will go with you, Dan, and then we'll go with you, Cindy, and then Kelly, and then I'll close things out. But we'll probably have to limit it to about 1 minute each. So go ahead.
Right. In brief, this evening while I was at the event in Bethel, Pennsylvania with Charles Strange, it was similar information that he had expressed on the show, and it was live and in person. And, of course, I know Charlie. But there were an awful lot of people who were there, local people, people from all over, people who represented other groups, people who have invited Charlie and myself to come visit their groups and share the information. And it's a really good cross-pollination. There's so much going on right now where finally all these different groups with different agendas and different methods are not just criticizing each other or ignoring each other, but they've decided that the fight is too important. And there's a Lehigh Valley group that is not the same as a Berks County group, which is not the same as a Schuylkill County or a Lebanon County group, but they've decided that they're going to work together on specific issues, just as, you know, I've been urging for so long, and it's heartwarming. It is heartwarming to see these people together in the same room, shaking hands, hugging each other, exchanging phone numbers, making plans, and it's happening. We're actually doing it, and I'm over the moon. It's just wonderful.
Awesome. It's great to hear finally working together. And so we will bring it over to you, Cindy. Go ahead.
Well, you know, our theme for tonight was right-sized government. What is the right-sized government? Well, in America, it's what the people say it is. And so if we want to have a very large government, then sit back and let the welfare recipients, make a big government for you, if that's what you're happy with. But if you're not happy with big government and you want smaller government, you better get busy and develop a strategy that will win the day, because we're headed that way to huge socialist fascist government, government that enters every aspect of your life, noses itself into every corner of your life, knows where you are, what you're doing, how you're doing it, how much money you're spending on it. And this is absolutely unacceptable to me. That's why I have joined the fight, because I have seen my computer really woke me up. I didn't have a computer until about 3 or 4 years ago. And that really woke me up, being able to see what was going on. People that are only relying on, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, whatever, to get their news and to find out what's going on, they can forget it, you know. So people need to be informed, and they need to get involved with shrinking government in their own town, or we're going to have what China has.
And unfortunately, Kelly, I'm going to have to go ahead and close things out because we only got about 3 minutes left here. So thanks, everyone, for coming up to the show tonight. And, of course, we want to thank Chris Monzel for coming on as well and staying the extra time that he did. And we'll look forward to seeing us at our regular time next week at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. So we'll end tonight as I do every night, and that is with the song by Aubrey Ashburn, and you can hear more of her music by going to www.aubreyashburn.com. AubreyAshburn.com. So take care, folks, and have a good night, and let's all just get some rest. So I will talk to you folks soon.
Sorry, Doug.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Night, everyone.
Thank you.